You can really see why they believed Lord Lucan would have been hidden in here.
The Lucan Obsession with me, Alex von Tunselman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday the 22nd of October. This is Today with Michelle Assane and Nick Robinson. The headlines this morning, more than 1,000 prisoners are due to be released early today as the government continues to try to tackle overcrowding in jails in England and Wales. The Justice Secretary has announced a review into how many people are sent to prison in the first place and will be speaking to Shabana Mahmood at 10 past 8. Our other main news headline this morning, police say a man has died and a further 15 people have been taken to hospital following a low-speed collision between passenger trains in Powys.
Also in today's programme, it is 2 weeks to US Election Day.
If you average the polls, Harris has about a 1, maybe a 2-point lead in the popular vote. But as you may know, the popular vote in the United States is not the way you elect a president.
We'll talk to a pollster and to people out campaigning for both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump and explain which states to watch and why. Here, water bills look set to rise by more than the regulator indicated 3 months ago. And will mark 60 years since this.
All right, Eliza, say it again.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
How much have attitudes to accents changed since My Fair Lady was released in 1964? The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
At least 1,000 more prisoners are due to be released early as part of the government's strategy to ease overcrowding in jails in England and Wales. During the summer, prisons were close to reaching capacity and 1,700 inmates were freed early last month. Ministers are also preparing to announce a review of prison sentencing. It will be led by the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawke, who said the focus would be on moving the justice system out of crisis. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
About 1,100 inmates sentenced to 5 years or more are being freed. They are coming out having served 40% of their time rather than 50%, as was the case before the crisis with prison places in the summer. The government says those released won't include murderers, rapists and other serious sexual offenders, but drug dealers and fraudsters will be among them. Separately, ministers have appointed the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawke to lead a review of prison sentencing. Among issues he will look at is whether or not tougher sentences are required for crimes against women and girls and what can be done to tackle prolific offending. BBC News understands the review will also consider scrapping shorter sentences and toughening community orders as an alternative to jail.
His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Probation, Martin Jones, has told the BBC he believes the high number of people being recalled to prison could undermine efforts to free up more space in jails under the early release scheme. In the first quarter of this year, for every 100 people released, 56 were recalled. Mr. Jones has been speaking to File on 4.
My assessment is that there is a significant risk that the amount of space that has been created by the SDS 40 changes will be reduced as a result of the high level of recalls that we've been seeing historically over a number of years now. I see no indication that there'll be fewer recalls as a result of this. So, of course, there will be some benefit, but it will be quickly chipped away at, and it's the reason why a hard look at recall is necessary for the long term.
You can hear more in File on 4, The Rise in Prison Recalls, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds tonight at 8 o'clock. The British Transport Police say a man has died and a further 15 people have been taken to hospital with non-life-threatening injuries following a collision between two passenger trains in mid-Wales. The First Minister of Wales, Eluned Morgan, said her thoughts were with all those involved. Our Wales correspondent Hal Griffiths reports.
The trains collided near the village of Llanbryn Mair at around 7:30 on Monday evening. One was carrying passengers from Shrewsbury towards Aberystwyth. The other was travelling in the opposite direction from Machynlleth. A passenger who says he was on the second train has told the BBC he slammed into a table in the carriage as it stopped suddenly. He then went to help remove the driver from the mangled cab at the front of the train. Paramedics, the fire service, police and the Coast Guard were all called to the collision as both trains were evacuated. One person was killed and a further 15 people were taken to hospital with injuries which are not believed to be life-threatening. British Transport Police say they're investigating what happened leading up to the crash.
Israel has maintained its bombardment of Lebanon overnight. The country's health ministry said 4 people, including a child, were killed in a strike outside the country's biggest government hospital in Beirut. The Israeli military said it had hit a Hezbollah target nearby. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken will land in Tel Aviv this morning on his 11th trip to the Middle East since the start of the war in Gaza. The BBC's Tom Bateman is travelling with him.
This trip was rushed together in the hours after Israel killed the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, when the Biden administration saw a chance to revive the diplomacy. The chances of any immediate progress appear close to nil. The Americans acknowledge there is no one currently to negotiate with as Hamas figures out who its leader is to make decisions and whether it will return to the table. Instead, Mr. Blinken is likely to focus on proposals for governing Gaza if and when the war ends.
The BBC understands water bills will rise more than expected over the next 5 years as the regulator Ofwat allows bigger increases to reflect higher costs and greater investment. Separately, the government is due to announce plans this week that could lead to the biggest overhaul of the water industry since the late 1980s. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Customers are already angry that water bills are set to rise when water companies seem to have failed. Water companies say they can't raise money to invest in improvements without higher bills and are stuck in a doom loop as the more they get fined, the less in the kitty to fix the things they're being fined for. Ofwat has to referee all this, and the BBC understands it will allow the water companies to raise bills over the next 5 years by more than the 21% on average they indicated in July. Numbers vary widely, but the increases in some cases, notably Thames Water, were less than half the rise they were asking for.
Artificial intelligence could be used to help doctors spot broken bones on X-rays, the health assessment body for England and Wales says. NICE, the National Institute for Care and Health Excellence, says that technology has the potential to reduce the number of fractures missed in urgent care. 4 AI tools are set to be recommended for use in England while more evidence is collected. New research has revealed that a huge meteorite that crashed into Earth 3 billion years ago caused a tsunami bigger than any in known human history, but then helped early life to thrive. The space rock, called S2, was 200 times the size of the one that wiped out the dinosaurs and caused global devastation when it hit. But scientists found the collision created spikes in phosphorus and iron, both essential ingredients for life.
Thank you, Jane. 7 minutes past six now. Let's see what the weather has in store for us. Simon King can tell us. Morning, Simon.
Good morning, Nick. Yeah, the weather's pretty quiet actually today and indeed into tomorrow as well. Lots of settled weather around, but we do have some rain this morning. That's across parts of southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and of course northern England as well. Some of that rain is a little bit heavy this morning, but it is going to ease off and it's going to push away to the southeast. So it'll do that pretty quickly actually. So for much of southwest England, Wales, Midlands, northern England, there'll be some sunny spells developing and maximum temperatures getting up to about 11 to 15 degrees. For southeast and eastern England, we've got a few mist patches this morning, but it's a largely dry day and it's going to be a largely sunny start to your Tuesday as well. But the cloud will increase by lunchtime with a chance of a few showers throughout the afternoon. Highs of 14 to 16 Celsius. Across Scotland today, some showers this morning in northern and western Scotland, a little bit breezy as well. Sunny spells for most though, and even though showers in the north and west will ease away, so a dry end to the day and temperatures of 10 to 13. And for Northern Ireland, dry with plenty of sunshine today, temperatures of 11 to 13 Celsius. Now, through tonight, we'll see the cloud increasing a little bit across northern and western areas of the UK. But for parts of England and Wales, we're going to see some pretty dense and widespread fog developing into Wednesday morning. And actually, for Wednesday, that fog is going to be pretty slow to clear away. So that could cause a few hazards first thing on Wednesday morning, particularly around southern areas of England. But it will eventually clear and there'll be more cloud in the north and the west.
Simon, thank you very much. 9 minutes past six is the time. Let's take you through the papers. And there are photographs of Chris Cabber on many of the front pages as the newspapers react to the acquittal of the police officer who shot him. Gun cop cleared is the Mirror's headline. Cleared in 3 hours, says the Sun, which highlights what it calls the police's fury at the murder trial. According to the Daily Telegraph, the Crown Prosecution Service is under fire from both Scotland Yard and MPs who are asking why Martin Blake was charged in the first place. The Times says there is anger on all sides, with a police source telling the paper Sergeant Blake was hardly a Michael Ryan. That's the man who shot dead 16 people in the Hungerford massacre in 1987. The source says that if prosecutors are trying to make an example of someone, no one will want to work as a firearms officer.
In its leader column, the Financial Times gives its verdict on the government's assessment that its overhaul of workers' rights will cost businesses up to £5 billion a year. The paper insists that the government's tax plans must avoid overburdening business and investors and calls on the Chancellor to tread carefully. In the Mail, the Shadow Business Secretary Kevin Hollenray writes that what he calls the draconian bill is a catastrophic own goal and an act of economic self-flagellation.
The front page of The Guardian reports on a revelation by the Archbishop of Canterbury that he's the descendant of a slave owner. The paper reports Justin Welby recently discovered that his biological father, with whom he had no relationship, was the great-great-grandson of Sir James Ferguson, who owned enslaved people on a sugar plantation in Jamaica. Sir James was compensated by the British government when slavery was abolished in the 1830s.
The Strictly Come Dancing star Giovanni Pannicci has spoken to the Daily Mail in his first interview since being accused of bullying his celebrity partner on the show. The BBC has upheld some of the complaints made by the actress Amanda Abington. But in the interview, Pannicci says the pair shared very rude banter, and while he acknowledges he sometimes got frustrated, he insists he did nothing wrong. He also tells the paper that he began filming rehearsals and asked for a chaperone in order to protect himself.
The Financial Times reports that the fashion brand Chanel is dipping its oar into sport for the first time by sponsoring the annual boat race between Oxford and Cambridge. It says that the contest is going to be renamed the Chanel J12 boat race after one of the company's high-end watches. I'm not sure. I mean, is Chanel going to do anything about the kit? I'm not sure how much you can do with rowers' kit.
Limited options, you would have thought there, isn't it? And the Mirror reports that a group of metal detectorists and a Somerset landowner have received a total of more than £4 million after discovering a hoard of 1,000-year-old coins. It says the silver pennies, which have been bought for the nation, feature representations of England's last Saxon king, Harold II, and its first Norman king, William the Conqueror. According to the Times, in their day, the 2,500 coins could have bought, wait for it, 500 sheep.
12 minutes past six.
2 weeks today, Americans go to the polls to decide whether Donald Trump will return to the White House or Kamala Harris will become their next president. I've been speaking to David Willis, our North America correspondent.
So tight this race still, Nick, that both candidates are battling to win over small pockets of undecided voters in a few key districts. And one pocket, spread amongst several districts, in fact, is evangelical Christians. And Kamala Harris visited two black churches in Georgia over the weekend in the company, in fact, of Stevie Wonder as part of a nationwide effort known amongst the Democrats as Souls to the Polls. Well, today, Donald Trump told a meeting of faith leaders in Concord, North Carolina, another swing state, that he'd survived the assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania, back in July, by virtue of what he called a supernatural hand that knocked him to the ground, ensuring that he was spared the gunman's bullet. And he went on to say that as he looked back on his life, he realised that the hand of God had led him to where he is today. Now, Donald Trump, of course, is seen by many here on the Christian right as something of a champion of religious liberty. And having survived that assassination attempt, many of his supporters do seem to believe that he has been divinely blessed. A recent poll suggested that Mr. Trump enjoys the overwhelming support of white Catholics and white evangelical Christians, but not the support of other faith communities, including Hispanic Catholics and Jewish and Muslim Americans, as well as black Protestants, who, of course, the majority of whom are said to support Kamala Harris.
If Donald Trump is hoping that God will save him, Kamala Harris seems to be hoping that Never Trumpers, those Republicans who loathe Donald Trump, might save her.
That's right, yeah. Vice President Kamala Harris has been campaigning alongside the former Republican lawmaker Liz Cheney in three of the so-called battleground or Rust Belt states, Nick, Pennsylvania, Michigan and Wisconsin, all part of a bipartisan appeal to Republicans who are on the fence, who are uneasy about Donald Trump, and to coerce them, in the hope of coercing them, to cross the aisle and help vote Kamala Harris into office. Now, Liz Cheney, who whose father, the former Vice President Dick Cheney, has also, of course, come out in support of Kamala Harris, urged disaffected Republicans to vote according to their conscience, adding that they could do so privately without letting on to friends or loved ones. It's an acknowledgement, I think, Nick, that a few thousand wavering voters in those key districts could easily decide who wins this presidential election.
David Willis, just a fortnight to go. It's all very exciting. Thank you.
It is 6:15. Two trains collided in Mid Wales yesterday evening, and it has been confirmed since that a man died in the crash. Craig Duggan is a reporter for BBC Wales and is at the scene now. Craig, how could this happen?
Well, that's the question that a lot of people are asking, Michelle. There is an ongoing investigation, and there has been some speculation from local people and also one of the passengers on one of the trains who BBC News spoke with last night. What I can tell you is that the Cambrian line, the track running through Mid Wales between Aberystwyth and Shrewsbury, is mostly single track. With passing places, short sections of track where it doubles so that trains can pass each other safely. There is a passing place close to the site of this collision, but from what local people were speculating last night, and one of the passengers said after leaving one of the trains, it seems that the train heading west wasn't able to stop at the passing place and to wait for the other train to pass it then before rejoining the single track. It seems from what the passenger said, it seemed to have slid along the rails beyond the passing loop and back onto the single stretch of track. With the train coming from the opposite direction towards it. They seem both to have been able to slow down, but not enough to avoid the collision, which it seems caused significant damage to the front of both trains. That's speculation and hasn't been confirmed by any official source, and the investigation is ongoing.
Are you able to see the wreckage, Craig, from where you are?
No, not from where I am here. I'm less than a mile from the site of the collision. I could see it better from a different vantage point last night, but obviously it was dark. I understand that both trains are still upright and on the tracks, but no, I haven't been able to see it, haven't been able to get close at the moment. There's a police van next to me here, which has blocked the A470, the main road between North and South Wales, which runs here adjacent to the railway line. The emergency services, fire, ambulance, police, and also paramedics who came on Coast Guard and air ambulance helicopters last night. They were using that piece of road to help the people get off the train, to take 15 people, we understand, to hospital with injuries which are described as not life-threatening or life-changing. But the sad news is that the police have confirmed that one passenger died in the collision. We understand it was a man, and that the next of kin have been informed and his family are being supported by specialist officers after that collision at about 7:30 last night near Llanbryn Mair in Powys.
Craig Duggan, thank you.
17 minutes past six. One number features on many front pages. £5 billion, the government's own estimate of the cost of workers' rights. Sean has more about that and the rest of the day's business news. Morning, Sean.
Yes, one number doesn't always tell the story, does it? But blimey, it makes you think about the consequences of these kind of impacts. The guarantee of rights like sick pay, protection from unfair dismissal, parental and bereavement leave for workers from the first day of employment. That'll be across Scotland, Wales and England. These changes, not in Northern Ireland, where employment law is devolved. The government's own impact assessment saying additional costs that come with it could lead to job losses, hurt economic growth, disproportionately impact smaller businesses as well, particularly those in lower paid industries. And it also lays out what potential benefits might be. Might be harder to put the number on the productivity benefits of having a happier workforce, people with more secure jobs, but say that that could be in the billions of pounds as well. Nimish Araja is the owner and chief executive of Nims Naturally, which was founded in 2012, makes a variety of products, including fruit and veg crisps. She joins me now. Morning, Nimisha.
Good morning, Sean.
Will these changes impact your business, cost-wise, strategy-wise?
I think it will impact every single business, won't it? I mean, I don't know. You know, Labour is obviously pro-employee, which is great, but you can't be anti-employer if you want to be pro-employee. I just don't understand when employers became pariahs in the eyes of Labour.
Became what, sorry?
Became pariahs. Mm. You know, it's as if suddenly we need lots and lots of rules and regulations to be brought in because employers are mistreating employees left, right and centre. And I mean, it's just not through. I mean, I don't know where all these laws are coming from. And to hit us with 24, no less than 24 new possible rules and regulations to contend with. And just as a small business, you can imagine, we would have to rewrite all contracts. And I think these are some laws they're bringing in over a period of 2 years. We would be having to write all these laws into contracts that we have for our employees over and over again.
But as Paul Novak says, the General Secretary of the TUC, saying these changes will mostly affect those companies whose business models have been built on low-paid, insecure employment. Decent employers will welcome these measures, the improvements they'll bring for the businesses and their workforces.
I think, what I'd like to understand is why somebody who perhaps would wake up, let's talk about, say, sick pay from day one. What is the rationale behind that? I mean, you know, we all feel sometimes, oh, we can't be bothered to go into work today. We've had a bit of a late night. Let's call in sick. People don't do that as much as perhaps they would, because they know that they're going to lose a whole day's pay. If you're going to offer sick pay from day one, we're more likely to have, I think by the end of a year, let's say, a lot more sick pay days than we've ever had before. You've then got...
But if you're not well to go into work, I guess the point is you should be able to do that on day one and not have to wait a few days.
This is not about most employees, and this is not about most employers. I understand there are rogue employers, and there are also employees who are not as honest and trustworthy as they could be. But each day lost, each day that we pay somebody for sick pay will cost us £23 at the moment. That's assuming Labour isn't going to increase the rate of pay.
Well, it seems the initial rates of pay, just you know, reading the reports this morning of sick pay, have been decreased, and saying that if you're off sick for actually a couple of weeks, relatively under these new rules, you'd lose out. But the rights come in earlier in your time in a job. I mean, would that make you feel a little bit more comfortable about it?
Possibly, but I'd like to understand the rationale behind it. I mean, what is this about? Why are we having... Also, well, let's go on. Fine. Let's talk about now the rights from day one to unfair dismissal. You know, if I can give you a scenario, we have rules in our food production factory that you're not allowed to work with your phones. It's just unhygienic. It's a rule. You cannot have your phone in production, have it during breaks. We employed somebody, quite rightly told that this is what the rules are. Day two of her employment, she was in production, standing there on her phone. And we said, look, you can't do this. We told you, you can't have your phone. She said, oh, you know, I suffer from anxiety if I don't have my phone with me. We had to let her go. A scenario like that under new rules would mean we would be tied into an unfair dismissal case where we would have to be paying lawyers to protect, to defend ourselves and to fight all these things. It's so onerous. All these new regulations on a very small business is really, really onerous and a lot for us to deal with.
I mean, do you think it will change? You know, been through a lot in 12 years running the business. You're going to be there another 12 years later?
Do you know, I've been in business for almost 40 years now, and I have never felt just so desperate and just so... I do. You feel like giving up. You think, what's the point? I'm going to go and get a job. But it does make you feel as if, you know, it's too much hard work being employers. And if Labour is saying that Conservatives have broken the NHS, I think Labour will be responsible for breaking, you know, some of the most tenacious and resilient people. And that's the small business owner, because I don't know how much we can cope with this.
Namisha Raja, thank you for joining us this morning. Owner and Chief Executive of NIMS, naturally. The Chancellor's own rules for managing the nation's finances set to change with next week's budget, using a different measure of the country's debt pile that would allow room for more borrowing for investment. What's the reason for these rules? I asked Gemma Tetlow, Chief Economist at the Institute for Government.
The big one for her at this budget will be convincing investors that they don't need to be worried about this government's commitment to retaining a fiscally sustainable position, that the government, when it comes to issuing new debt over the next few years, that it can find a willing market for that debt, because investors are happy that if they give money to government now, that they will get that money back when they're owed it.
Now, one of those investors may well be Jason Borbashin, who keeps a close eye on government borrowing costs as co-head of income strategy at 91, which is a company on the FTSE 250, manages £130 billion in assets. Jason, morning to you.
Hi, morning, Sean.
You know, we heard much and we will hear plenty more about what kind of changes might well happen in the budget next week regarding these rules. But I wonder what you're looking out for specifically that might make you think government borrowing costs may go up or down.
Sure. So we run a conservative strategy that's really seeking to protect capital. And the experience of 2022 for many investors in UK government debt, during which there was a significant capital depreciation in the bonds, I think weighs pretty heavy. And I think that's what your prior guest was alluding to. So the big change that potentially might come is to the fiscal rules. These are laid out by the government themselves. They've already essentially messaged a change to one, which is on spending. The other is essentially on the trajectory of debt from here. And the current measure of that, which is public sector net debt, including transfers to the Bank of England, excluding transfers to the Bank of England, rather, would be set to breach the target for it to reduce relative to GDP of the economy over the next 5 years. And their suggestion is that essentially, or suggestions that have been put forward, we could change that measure either to include those transfers, which would, whilst raising the actual level of debt to GDP, put it below, at least on the current estimates, the current level in 5 years, or to include a broader measure. And it's that broader measure which is causing the concern.
Okay, so just if you can briefly just explain what the broader measure might be that and what concern that might have, what consequences that would have.
So it would be, I think, smaller failure to include those Bank of England transfers which relate to the bond purchases made during primarily the pandemic. That would be about 0.6% of GDP that would be provided for headroom for borrowing. If we include the concept of net financial liabilities, that has more difficult to measure inclusions, so things like money from student loans, and that would take the headroom to about 50 billion. And then further still is this concept of public sector net worth, and that has very, very difficult to measure indeed concepts, so buildings and transportation, and that ultimately would add around 2%.
Okay.
GDP.
Make
now, I emphasize that in and of itself, that would not necessarily cause a tantrum in the way that we saw in 2022. It would need, though, to come with some pretty strict definitions of how this is to be managed. And really, that's what investors want. It's certainty and guidance.
Thank you very much, Jason Borbashin there from 91. Tantrums in the investment market. No tantrums from Jane Sydenham, Investment Director at Rathbones Investment Management. Hi, Jane.
Morning.
Just wanted to check in with you on Hollywood Bowl, our biggest bowling operator. Full year sales at a record level, expects profits to be up. What's it doing right there?
Yeah, no, it's good, isn't it? It's good news. I mean, there's always this sense that life on the high street's getting more difficult. But I think, you know, record revenues from them, you know, they're obviously appealing to this sort of trend where consumers want to go out and have a good night and enjoy themselves, but don't necessarily just want to go drinking. So these leisure venues like Hollywood Bowl, like the Sixes, the cricket venue, golf, etc., are becoming really quite popular. And Hollywood Bowl are obviously managing their business well. They're conserving their cash. They're keeping their costs under control. So, you know, they're doing a good job.
Got your social calendar lined up for the next few weeks as well, Jane, by the sounds of it. And VW Finance said that the big lending arm of, unsurprisingly, the massive car giant Volkswagen, has landed with a fine by regulators here in the UK, a £5 million or so fine, for failing to treat customers in financial difficulty fairly. What's this one all about?
So I think a lot of finance companies started to find that consumers were falling behind on their repayments as interest rates went up very, very quickly in 2022. So it put a lot of pressure on consumers. Some of the finance companies haven't necessarily handled this very well. And in VW's case, you know, they've been fined. They're also having to compensate quite a lot of customers as a result of this, because they hadn't really engaged with them. They hadn't you know, asked them all the right questions, and the FCA was very unhappy about the way they'd been treated.
Jane, good to catch up with you. Thank you. Jane Sydenham there, Investment Director at Rathbones. I'll be back after seven with a bit more of a look at the state of our public finances, government borrowing, spending, all of that. We get the latest official figures just then.
Look forward to that. Whether the Chancellor will, Sean, we will see. It is 29 minutes past six. Here's Simon with the sports news.
Thank you, Nick. And it was a frustrating evening for Crystal Palace as an error from their goalkeeper, Dean Henderson, enabled Nottingham Forest to snatch a 1-0 win and move up to eighth in the Premier League in the process. Henderson allowed a Chris Wood strike from outside the penalty area to squirm beneath his outstretched arm, but Palace manager Oliver Glasner refused to lay the blame for the defeat at the feet of his goalkeeper.
No, didn't cost us the game. It's part of football, and especially the goalkeepers, they are so expressed, and any mistake of a goalkeeper is usually a goal you concede, and no. So Dean had so many saves for us, he will have so many saves for us, so he doesn't need to apologise, not to me and not to the team.
Crystal Palace are third bottom of the Premier League table, though still without a win this season and having scored fewer goals than any other side. The Wolves manager Gary O'Neill has been contacted by the Football Association and asked to explain himself after he suggested referees could have a problem with unconscious bias towards bigger clubs. After Wolves lost 2-1 to Manchester City in the Premier League, O'Neill questioned why John Stones' stoppage time goal was allowed to stand by a VAR review after their goalkeeper appeared to be blocked. The BBC Sport pundit and columnist Chris Sutton thinks Gary O'Neill is on a hiding to nothing.
I don't think that was the case. I actually thought it was a really good use of VAR. I think Gary O'Neill is massively clutching. And I think because we have VAR now, it's like they don't get everything right, that more often than not, I think we understand what their thinking is.
The league stage of the Champions League continues tonight. Arsenal are at home to Shakhtar Donetsk and Aston Villa play Bologna. And the 2020 US Open champion and former world number 3 Dominic Thiem could play the last tennis match of his career later today. The Austrian is playing his final tournament in Vienna and faces Luciano Darderi in front of his home crowd this afternoon. And ahead of his swan song, he told me he had mixed feelings.
It's already the 14th time I'm playing in Vienna, and of course, I know it's going to be the last one, so it's really strange. But at the same time as well, a big relief, because the last month and weeks, they were very emotional. It was like a roller coaster of emotions. But in general, I'm looking forward to relive all the emotions one more time, to play in front of this great crowd one more time.
And just to finish with a stat, Thiem is the only player other than Sir Andy Murray to have beaten each of the big three, Djokovic, Federer and Nadal, at least five times, Nick.
Impressive stuff. Thank you, Simon. Let's look ahead now to Thursday morning.
Strong message here from BBC Radio 4.
A brand new series with me, Armando Iannucci.
And me, Helen Lewis.
A show all about the use and abuse of political language, where we take back control of the airwaves.
And tell you what we're hearing on the doorstep.
Just what do these phrases actually mean?
Can you be part of the metropolitan elite if you live in the countryside?
And what does turbocharge mean? And why do politicians need to say it every 5 minutes?
Exploring the verbal tricks of the trade.
And the effect it has on the rest of us.
Strong message here starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On Thursday morning at 9:45.
The time is now just after 6:30. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson, Michelle Hussein and Jane Steele with the news.
More than 1,000 inmates are to be released early to ease overcrowding in prisons across England and Wales. Jails were close to reaching full capacity during the summer. Murderers, rapists and other serious sex offenders won't be among those freed, but drug dealers and fraudsters will be. His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Probation, Martin Jones, has told the BBC he believes the high number of people being recalled to prison could undermine efforts to free up more space in jails under the early release scheme. The Lebanese Health Ministry says 4 people, including a child, have been killed in the latest Israeli airstrikes in Beirut. The blast reportedly came close to hitting the country's biggest government hospital. Israel says they struck a Hezbollah target near the hospital and that the facility had not been hit. Meanwhile, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is set to land in Tel Aviv this morning on his 11th trip to the Middle East since the start of the war in Gaza. A man has died and a further 15 people have been taken to hospital with non-life-threatening injuries after 2 passenger trains collided in mid-Wales. The crash occurred near Llanbryn Mawr in Powys yesterday evening. All other passengers have now been evacuated from both trains. The BBC understands water bills will rise more than previously thought over the next 5 years. The regulator Ofwat is preparing to allow bigger increases to reflect higher costs and greater investment. The government is also set to announce plans expected to lead to the biggest overhaul of the water industry since privatisation in the late 1980s. Artificial intelligence could be used to help doctors spot broken bones on X-rays. The health assessment body for England and Wales, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, says the technology has the potential to reduce the number of fractures missed in urgent care. A meteorite the size of Greater London, which crashed into Earth 3 billion years ago, may have helped ancient life thrive. Research suggests although the space rock caused global devastation, it also led to a spike in single-cell life.
Jane, thank you. 26 minutes to seven. More than 1,000 prisoners are being released early today. It's the second time there's been significant numbers released early in just a few weeks since the government was elected. Perhaps even greater significance comes when the Justice Secretary announces a review of who gets sent to prison in the first place. Let's discuss all that with our home editor, Mark Easton. Mark, with the early release, first of all, they had some problems with the first early release, didn't they? So they'll be worried again.
Yes, this has the potential, I think, to be a very embarrassing day for the Ministry of Justice. Some particularly unpleasant individuals are being freed weeks or months earlier than the courts and victims, of course, thought that they would be. But the Ministry of Justice, as you would expect, is blaming the last lot it inherited. It says a prison system in crisis within days of collapse. And to be fair, the estate is supposed always to have at least 1,500 spare cells so they can move people around, so they make the system sort of work. But at the moment, there are just 1,350. It's been even much, it's been more crowded than that. The signs are it could be very crowded in a few months' time. And despite a prison building programme, as you say, the government worried that prisons are going to remain dangerously overcrowded for years unless they do something. So today we're beginning to hear about the something.
Yeah, and what's intriguing about the something is that it's a former Conservative Justice Secretary who's been appointed, essentially to give cover, I suspect, political cover, to the idea of sending fewer people to prison in the first place.
Yeah, well, you will remember Michael Howard, former Conservative Home Secretary, former Tory leader, of course, saying prison works 30 years ago. Well, I think today the Labour government and David Gawk, former Conservative Lord Chancellor, are saying, well, the system in England, Wales isn't working right now. It costs a fortune and offending is off the charts. It's time to rethink. I think this is quite a big deal. The sentencing review announced today will be questioning the effectiveness of short custodial sentences. We have been here before, but it'll also be asking whether the framework of longer sentences, whether that also needs an overhaul. In effect, the government is looking to send fewer people to prison for less time, although, of course, they do stress there must always be a cell waiting for the dangerous offenders, and they want tough out-of-prison punishments for the rest. I think that's going to be the big key. How are they going to be able to replace custodial sentences with something that is going to be acceptable to the public in the community?
Mark Easton, our home editor, will be hearing from the Justice Secretary at 10 past 8.
23 minutes to 7 now. It looks as though water companies will be able to raise customers' bills by more than the 21% above inflation that the regulator indicated a few months ago. At least that's how it appears from what Simon Jack, our business editor, has discovered. Is this the regulator going back on what they said a few months ago, Simon?
Well, there's always a little bit of argy-bargy. You know, the companies say, this is how much we need. The Ofwat say, you've got to be kidding, you can have a bit less than that. And then they come back and have this iterative process. But in the case of this particular round, which happens every 5 years, the regulator had agreed to what was the biggest rise above inflation of any five-year period since privatisation. And therefore, it was thought they were going to hold the line and just basically be a little tougher with the water companies. But it was much less than the 21% on average they agreed was much less than some were asking for. The numbers vary widely from company to company. In the case of Thames and Southern, two heavily indebted companies, it was less than half they were asking for. Since then, as I say, these companies, all of them have had a chance to make their case. And I understand Ofwat will allow bills to rise by more than the average 21% above inflation they suggested back in July. They'll make a final decision in December or possibly January. Whether that will be enough to narrow the gap for what companies say they need remains to be seen.
So how much more could it be?
Well, but we don't know, and it would vary by company to company. But there's a widespread view that regulation of this industry hasn't worked over the last few years. In some areas, keeping bills low was prioritised by above and beyond ensuring sufficient investment. Shareholders were allowed to take too much debt, to take too much money out, to let debt pile up. So you have this doom loop where ageing infrastructure fails, the company gets fined, there's then less money to fix the very thing they just got fined for. So I understand tomorrow DEFRA will announce a major commission with a high-profile chair, which officials say could lead to the biggest overhaul in the industry since privatization, because at the moment customers are unhappy, water companies say they can't fix the things that people are unhappy with the amount of money they actually have. So look out for that on Wednesday, a large commission with a high-profile chair to oversee potentially the biggest overhaul of how this industry is run since privatization.
Simon, thanks very much.
It is now 21 minutes to 7. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is due in Tel Aviv this morning on his 11th trip to the Middle East since the start of the Gaza War. Travelling with him is our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman.
Well, this trip was hurried together shortly after Israel killed Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas. And really, the Biden administration had eyed an opportunity, as it saw it, to try and reinstate the moribund diplomatic process to get a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. There were basically two reasons the thing fell apart many weeks ago now. One is what the Americans have been very much focused on, is that they say Hamas simply walked away from this deal, that Yahya Sinwar just disappeared, basically, and wasn't responding to any of the outreach from the mediators, Qatar. On the other hand, Benjamin Netanyahu had repeatedly sort of upped his conditions to a point where some said it just made the deal unobtainable, including some within Israel. So there were two obstacles to the deal. Now, the Americans think they've got an opportunity here to get it going again, to revive that diplomacy. But I think they're now up against another issue, which is that they haven't really got anyone to negotiate with on the Hamas side in these mediated talks that are brokered by Qatar and Egypt. And that is because Hamas doesn't know who its key decision maker is at the moment. They haven't announced a new leader. If they do, they'll probably keep that person's identity secret. So it's not clear at all they're going to come back to the negotiating table. At the same time, there are very few signs from Mr. Netanyahu that he's in the mood for diplomacy. When you look at what's happening on the ground in northern Gaza with a very, very fierce intensification of the Israeli assault on the north of the Gaza Strip. You know, Israel says it's routing a Hamas resurgence there. You know, aid groups are warning of the possibility of civilians there starving to death because of the Israeli military siege, particularly around Jabalia refugee camp. So that gives you a flavour of, I think, just how challenging this trip is going to be for Mr. Blinken. And in the meantime, I think they're trying to fill the discussions with several other things. One of those, trying to refine the post-war plan, the so-called day-after plan for Gaza, and also try to make progress on de-escalating the war in Lebanon at the same time.
That's Tom Bateman, our State Department correspondent, and let's have a quick look at the papers now at 18 minutes to 7. The dominant story across the front pages is the acquittal of the police firearms officer who shot dead Chris Cabba in his car. He's been cleared of murder. Gun cop cleared is the Mirror's headline. Cleared in 3 hours, the Sun says, a reference to how long it took the jury to return that verdict. It's the same story leading the Guardian. Anger on all sides as Met officer cleared of murder, says the Times, because the Chris Cabba family are very upset about the verdict. And the Telegraph saying the Crown prosecution is under fire from politicians and the police after a jury took just 3 hours to find a hero officer not guilty of the murder of a man shot dead in South London.
As we were hearing in the business news, a big number is on the front page of many papers. The Mail has the headline, £5 billion cost of Labour's revolution for workers. This is the official assessment of the cost of the new workers' rights package. The Financial Times uses that number as well. well, although the government assessment was it would not get to quite 5 billion. The FT reports Paul Novak, General Secretary of the TUC, saying that despite repeated attempts to paint this bill as bad for business, the assessment showed that costs were negligible, in his words, and are more than offset by the wider economic and social gain. The Times quotes that as well, but goes on to say actually it's small firms that will particularly hard hit by what is happening. And the Sun says, workers wronged by Rayner's rights.
And that story about Chanel and the boat race, it does seem, it's on the front page of the Financial Times, it does seem it is very much about watches and time rather than
smelling
clothes or fragrance. Yes, because it's also going to become
smelling rowers.
The event's official timekeeper.
Which, presumably at the end of a long row, well, let's not go there.
Yeah.
About the smell. Let's move on. Rapidly. 16 minutes to 7. The government says it's delivering a transformative change for working people with its employment rights bill. The first big debate on the plans was held yesterday in Parliament. But the Conservatives warned the proposals could have a devastating impact on small businesses. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
After endless headlines about ministerial freebies, the winter fuel payment, the two-child limit and the looming budget, Labour MPs were ready for some enthusiastic cheering when the Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner got to her feet to begin the debate on her employment rights bill.
Mr Speaker, I beg to move that the bill now be read a second time, and I declare that I'm a lifelong proud trade union member.
The bill would, among other things, give workers the right to claim unfair dismissal from day one, allow them to request flexible working from the start of a job and claim statutory sick pay from the first day they're ill. It also bans fire and rehire, makes changes to the way zero-hours contracts work and repeals some of the Conservatives' union laws. Angela Rayner said for her it was personal. She'd once been a carer on an unsteady income.
That fear stuck with me. I've not been able to provide for my young family or losing everything. And now that I'm at the Cabinet table, I'm determined to deliver for the millions of people in the position that I was once in.
The Conservative Shadow Business Minister, Kevin Holinrake, said no one on the government front bench had actually run a business as he had.
As Winston Churchill put it, they are the strong horse that pulls the whole cart. The question I ask myself now is when this legislation is in place, would I start that small business again today? Sadly, the answer would probably be no.
Jane Kirkham, a Labour MP, interrupted.
Does the Right Honourable Member remember in 1997 and 98 when the party opposite said that the social chapter and the national minimum wage would cost half a million jobs? Yes. And in the late 1990s, half a million jobs were actually created.
But Kevin Holinrake didn't think that was quite the same. The minimum wage had affected all businesses, while what Labour was proposing would disproportionately affect small firms. And his Conservative colleague Graham Stewart could see how.
Someone can fail to turn up for work on day one, claiming that they are sick, and then because they will now have rights against unfair dismissal, they will be able, without ever doing a day's work, to be able to hold a small business to ransom and put that business at risk.
Richard Bergen, an independent MP, couldn't see that happening, and he had a question for Kevin Holinrake.
I listen with interest to what the Shadow Minister is saying about people being entitled to go all the way to an employment tribunal hearing from the moment they take up employment. Has the Shadow Minister ever heard of pre-hearing reviews in employment tribunals?
The point I was making is that it may go all the way to an employment tribunal, as he knows, but it also will be the cost of defending it even if it doesn't. That small business will have to bring consultants in, will have to speak to lawyers. That itself will cost money.
The government had that morning released an impact assessment for the bill. It said the cost of upgrading workers' rights could be £5 billion a year, though it went on to argue that was a modest amount compared to how much companies spent on employing people overall, and there would be other benefits to the change. Kevin Holinrake wasn't impressed.
Increased industrial action and tax rises to pay for increased pay demands. Check your impact assessment. 1970s, here we come. There is much, much short, much, much more, but in short, Madam Speaker, it will all mean that the tail will be wagging the dog.
The Lib Dems broadly backed the bill, but speaking for the party, Sarah Gibson didn't think the plans for carers or on sick pay went far enough.
at £116.75 per week, statutory sick pay remains far below the minimum wage. And it's effectively a disincentive to take time off.
The SNP's Chris Law reckoned many of Labour's plans had been kicked into the long grass of consultation, and others, like the right to switch off outside the office, were missing altogether.
This is government looking overly cautious and hesitant. But what people have been writing to me about in these last weeks is this is because they want to delay to find a convenient way out of implementing them.
The bill comfortably cleared its first parliamentary hurdle, but MPs will now be putting the work in to look at it in more detail.
Alicia McCarthy reporting. You can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on digital radio.
President Putin is hosting an international summit today. 36 countries are attending the BRICS meeting of emerging economies, with China's Xi Jinping and India's Narendra Modi among the leaders there. Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, is in Kazan, east of Moscow, where the summit is being held. What does President Putin want to do with this gathering, Steve?
Well, first of all, this is about symbolism. I mean, 2.5 years ago, when Vladimir Putin launched his full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Western nations vowed to isolate him, right? They dubbed him a pariah. So this summit gives him an opportunity, I think, to send a message to his own people, but also the outside world, that attempts to isolate him and to isolate Russia have failed because, as you mentioned, more than 20 heads of state are coming here. He'll be shaking hands, he'll be sitting around the table, and so the message will be, the West may not like me, but there are plenty of world leaders prepared to do business with me.
I mentioned India and China. Who else is there?
Lots. The president of Iran is coming, leader of South Africa. And there will be a BRICS meeting. There are currently 9 members of BRICS. The following day, there'll be a BRICS Plus meeting. More than 30 countries will be represented there. And the phrase you're going to hear a lot this week from Russian officials is global majority. So they claim that BRICS and other countries that want to cooperate with BRICS now represent the global majority. Russia is, I think, trying to use BRICS to shape a new global order. The problem is that BRICS is not a group of like-minded souls. So if you look at the current BRICS members, there are big differences between China and India. There are differences between Egypt and Ethiopia. Relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia have not been good. And then on the one hand, you have Russia, which is motivated by anti-Western sentiment to a large degree. And then you have other countries sitting at the table like India, which, all right, they talk about a new global order, but they want to retain good working relations, political, economic relations with the West. So plenty of differences within the countries in Kazan this week. So I think Vladimir Putin will try to sort of skim over the differences and try to emphasize things that unite these countries.
But as you say, Steve, it is interesting that where he is so isolated and Russia is so sanctioned by countries in the West, he is still able to have a summit like this with 36 countries willing to be present.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you're Putin and, you know, you've been dubbed a pariah, there's an international arrest warrant issued by the International Criminal Court for your arrest. Sanctions are trying to cut off your economy from the global economy. This kind of event is perfect to show that that's not working. And also, there are reports that the UN Secretary General will be here too and holding a meeting with Vladimir Putin. Once again, Moscow is going to use that to make the point that, you know, attempts to isolate the Kremlin leader have failed.
And how long does it last?
Well, the world leaders arrive later today. The summit proper gets going tomorrow. It's not going to last very long. Then the following day, a wider meeting with more countries. But Vladimir Putin will also hold, I think, 17 bilateral meetings with world leaders. So I think this is going to be wall-to-wall in the Russian state media here, making the case that Russia is centre stage of global politics.
Steve Rosenberg, Russia editor, thank you.
7 minutes to 7 now. If you or a loved one go for an X-ray in future to see if you've got a broken bone, the image may well be analysed by a computer and not just by a person, by a radiologist. Joining us now is Richard Evans, who's Chief Executive of the Society of Radiographers, joining us to talk about a new trial, in effect, isn't it, Richard, of using these AI tools. What can they do which a radiographer can't do on their own?
Well, good morning, Nick. The AI provides an extra set of eyes, if you like, of metaphorical eyes to look at the images that are produced. Trained healthcare professionals are still going to be a vital part of the chain. The radiographer or the radiographic assistant will take the images, but too often there are few people around in the emergency departments who are fully trained to give a definitive report on those images. So that important evaluation on the spot, which is currently done by radiographers and perhaps a radiologist or another healthcare professional in the emergency department, will have an extra set of tools to help them evaluate the images and detect any fractures.
The tech, the AI, spots breaks in bones that occasionally medically trained staff miss, is the reality, isn't it?
Yeah, missed fractures are a problem. They're a problem for the patient, clearly, because they don't get properly treated. They're a problem for the healthcare service generally, because people develop longer-term conditions as a result of missed fractures. But it needs to be understood that sometimes fractures just aren't visible on the image at all. So I think that human factor, the inquiry about that, you know, this patient has got something badly wrong, I think it's a fracture, I'm going to have another look, it's important. That's something the machine can't do.
Can I pursue that with you? Are you saying that if you relied on tech alone, with perhaps one kind of supervising radiographer or radiologist, are you saying the tech alone would miss things that a human being will always spot?
If a fracture is just not visible in the image, but there's a high level of suspicion that something is going wrong, a human can decide to take another picture, for example, to see if they can see it, right, and investigate further. At the moment, that's not something that AI offers. What it does offer is that additional set of metaphorical eyes, another opinion to help ensure that fractures aren't missed when they are visible on the images.
I hear you stress another additional pair of eyes, but isn't the reality, if we are talking 10, 20 years' time, the AI will do most of this on its own? Trained, of course, by, supervised, of course, by, checked by occasionally experts that are in your organisation, the Society of Radiographers, but tech's going to do most of this, isn't it?
Well, currently, it's a legal requirement for the final report on an image to be undertaken by a registered clinical professional, a radiologist or a radiographer, typically. So the law would have to change. But
if the government, looking for more efficiency and more savings, were to say, right, let's change the law, let us use this technology, is there any reason not to?
No, I think that we would expect, and we've always seen in our profession, technology develop and become better at assisting the healthcare process. That's what we all support and we want to see. I don't see that human interaction that the radiographer provides with the patient can be overtaken by a machine just yet, however clever they get and however much we come to rely on them, which I'm sure we will more and more.
Fascinating. Richard Evans, Chief Executive of the Society of Radiographers, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Now, here's a message from Children in Need.
Maths book, pencil case, oh, water bottle, always forget that. Trainers, calculator, anxiety. I'll bury that at the bottom.
Some children carry more than others, but with our help, their mental health issues can feel lighter. BBC Children in Need. We're there for you.
7:02. Time for the weather. Here's Simon King.
Nick, thanks so much indeed. Yeah, we've got some fairly quiet weather actually over the next couple of days or so. A bit of rain in the forecast today, and for tomorrow it's going to be fog. That'll be the main hazard, I guess, for some parts, especially around central and southern parts of England. But for today in southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and northern England, quite a bit of cloud out there at the moment with some rain this morning. That's quite heavy in some parts, especially around parts of northwest England at the moment. But the cloud and the rain is going to move south and eastward pretty quickly this morning, so that sunny spells develop for all parts, certainly by lunchtime, and temperatures get to about 11 to 15 degrees. In southeast and eastern England, a few mist patches around this morning, but it's going to be a mostly sunny start to Tuesday. Cloud will increase by lunchtime with a chance of some showers throughout the afternoon, highs of 14 to 16 degrees. Across Scotland, showers across the north and the west of Scotland, quite breezy conditions as well, but those showers will start to ease away, so this afternoon is looking drier. Sunny spells for most of Scotland then, and at temperatures of 10 to 13 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland today, dry with plenty of sunshine, highs of 11 to 13 degrees. But it's through tonight and through the later stages of tonight where we're going to see some quite extensive fog developing across England and Wales, especially across southern and eastern areas. It'll be dense fog for tomorrow morning, which could be hazardous. So if you're setting out early, watch out for that. The fog will be slow to clear, lifting up into low cloud. Eventually, there'll be some sunny spells, more cloud the further north and west you are across the UK.
Simon, thank you. You're listening to Today with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussain.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 22nd of October. The headlines this morning: more than 1,000 prisoners are due to be released early as the government continues to try to tackle overcrowding in jails in England and Wales. Police say a man has died and a further 15 people have been taken to hospital following a low-speed collision between passenger trains in Powys. And the BBC understands water bills will go up by more than previously thought over the next 5 years, as the regulator allows bigger increases to reflect higher costs and greater investment.
In the next half hour, with the US election exactly 2 weeks away, a pollster's take.
If you average the polls, Harris has about a 1, maybe a 2-point lead in the popular vote. But as you may know, the popular vote in the United States is not the way you elect a president.
The Premier League versus Manchester City, why that legal battle has sparked warnings it could spell the end of the league itself. And before 8 o'clock, the Poet and the Mega Arena, how John Cooper Clarke is going to headline Manchester's Co-op Live. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
At least 1,000 more prisoners are due to be released early as part of the government's strategy to ease overcrowding in jails in England and Wales. During the summer, prisons were close to reaching capacity and 1,700 inmates were freed early last month. Ministers are also preparing to announce a review of prison sentencing. It will be led by the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawk, who said the focus would be on moving the justice system out of crisis and towards a long-term sustainable future. Here's our senior UK correspondent Seema Kotecha.
About 1,100 inmates sentenced to 5 years or more are being freed. They are coming out having served 40% of their time rather than 50%, as was the case before the crisis with prison places in the summer. The government says those released won't include murderers, rapists and other serious sexual offenders, but drug dealers and fraudsters will be among them. Separately, ministers have appointed the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawk to lead a review of prison sentencing. Among issues he will look at is whether or not tougher sentences are required for crimes against women and girls and what can be done to tackle prolific offending.
With more details on the government's review into sentencing, here's our home and legal correspondent Dominic Casciani.
This sentencing review is aimed less at solving the current crisis and more at preventing it ever happening again. The government wants to reshape and redesign punishment with a focus on rehabilitation schemes that work and are specific to different types of offenders. The review will look at options for creating prison outside prison, including the case for sentencing some offenders to a modern form of house arrest monitored by technological advances in tagging. Officials also want to look at smartwatch-like devices piloted in some parts of the United States, which send messages to offenders to encourage them to comply with their rehabilitation program. The review reports back next spring, and any reforms could take a further year to deliver. Official projections, however, warn by that time the prisons could be full again if the government's emergency measures to manage the population fail.
The British Transport Police say a man has died and a further 15 people have been taken to hospital with non-life-threatening injuries following a collision between two passenger trains in mid-Wales. The First Minister of Wales, Eluned Morgan, said her thoughts were with all those involved. Our Wales correspondent Hal Griffiths reports.
The trains collided near the village of Llanbryn Mair at around 7:30 on Monday evening. One was carrying passengers from Shrewsbury towards Aberystwyth. The other was travelling in the opposite direction from Machynlleth. A passenger who says he was on the second train has told the BBC he slammed into a table in the carriage as it stopped suddenly. He then went to help remove the driver from the mangled cab at the front of the train. Paramedics, the fire service, police and the Coast Guard were all called to the collision as both trains were evacuated. One person was killed and a further 15 people were taken to hospital with injuries which are not believed to be life-threatening. British Transport Police say they're investigating what happened leading up to the crash.
Israel has maintained its bombardment of Lebanon overnight. The country's health ministry said four people, including a child, were killed in a strike outside the country's biggest government hospital in Beirut. The Israeli military said it had hit a Hezbollah target nearby. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, will land in Tel Aviv this morning on his 11th trip to the Middle East since the start of the war in Gaza. The BBC's Tom Bateman is travelling with him.
This trip was rushed together in the hours after Israel killed the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, when the Biden administration saw a chance to revive the diplomacy. The chances of any immediate progress appear close to nil. The Americans acknowledge there is no one currently to negotiate with as Hamas figures out who its leader is to make decisions and whether it will return to the table. Instead, Mr. Blinken is likely to focus on proposals for governing Gaza if and when the war ends.
The BBC understands water bills will rise more than expected over the next 5 years as the regulator Ofwat allows bigger increases to reflect higher costs and greater investment. Separately, the government is due to announce plans this week that could lead to the biggest overhaul of the water industry since the late 1980s. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Customers are already angry that water bills are set to rise when water companies seem to have failed. Water companies say they can't raise money to invest in improvements without higher bills and are stuck in a doom loop as the more they get fined, the less in the kitty to fix the things they're being fined for. Ofwat has to referee all this, and the BBC understands it will allow the water companies to raise bills over the next 5 years by more than the 21% on average they indicated in July. Numbers vary widely, but the increases in some cases, notably Thames Water, were less than half the rise they were asking for.
King Charles has visited the birthplace of the Aboriginal civil rights movement on the final day of his Australian tour. The visit came a day after he was heckled in the country's parliament by an Aboriginal senator. Meanwhile, a prominent Indigenous activist who was shouting anti-monarchist slogans was arrested at the Sydney Opera House, where crowds were gathering to catch a glimpse of the royal couple later in the day. From Sydney, our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph sent this report.
On the King and Queen's final day of engagements in Sydney, the crowds turned out in their thousands at the Opera House for the chance to chat to the royal couple ahead of a military review and a flypast. After yesterday's protest at the Canberra Parliament, a man was arrested close to the Opera House for shouting anti-monarchist slogans. Wayne Wharton is a well-known activist for Indigenous communities and has been at several events attended by the King and Queen in recent days. There were shouts of God save the King from royal supporters as he was arrested. Earlier, the King met doctors carrying out pioneering treatments for cancer in Australia and, with the Queen, attended a community barbecue where they were shown a number of different ways of making a sausage sandwich.
In the last few minutes, figures just released show public borrowing last month stood at £16.6 billion. It's the third highest September borrowing figure on record. It continues a trend of borrowing being consistently over the OBR forecast. England's health assessment body has said artificial intelligence has the potential to reduce the number of fractures and broken bones missed when doctors analyse X-rays. NICE, the National Institute for Care and Health Excellence, says the technology could be used to support the work of stretched healthcare professionals. The programme of sports for the Glasgow 2026 Commonwealth Games has been announced. It includes athletics, cycling, boxing, judo and bowls, but the scaled-down event doesn't have room for sports including badminton and shooting. Here's our sports news correspondent Chris McLaughlin.
Organisers say 3,000 athletes will compete across 10 sports from the 23rd of July until the 2nd of August. The limited budget means just 4 venues will be used, and there's no place for hockey, badminton, table tennis, rugby sevens, triathlon, squash or shooting. Glasgow secured the Games after the Australian state of Victoria pulled out due to financial concerns. The £120 million budget is being picked up mainly by the Commonwealth Games Federation, with politicians saying not a penny of public money will be used. Glasgow last hosted in 2014 at a cost of over £540 million.
Chris McLaughlin reporting.
Jane, thank you very much. 9 minutes past seven is the time. Our water bills are set to rise by more than the 21% above inflation that the regulator suggested in July water companies would be held to. Instead, the BBC has learnt that Ofwat is going to allow bigger increases. It's part of a system of negotiating on that topic. And the BBC has also learnt that there is going to be a new water commission. Fergal Sharkey joins us, clean water campaigner, who's talked to us several times on this subject on the programme before. I think I can guess what you think of the idea of bills going up by more than previously said, Fergal.
It is just this chaotic shambles that Ofwat and the industry have managed to get itself into. I suspect some of the background of all of this, again, a situation facilitated by Ofwat. Of the 17 companies involved in the water industry, 14 of them are actually carrying levels of gearing, i.e. debt on their balance sheets, way higher than Ofwat would like to see. So the truth is, these companies have absolutely little of any margin to go to the markets, to raise money, to go and fix a system they created in a situation of their doing. It is extraordinary that Ofwat feels it can now justify an increase of anything resembling 44%. For Southern Water customers, and as I thought at the time, the so-called average 21% was nothing more than a smokescreen and Ofwat indeed simply playing with the news agenda and trying to paint everything in a good light.
Well, there is a process of going back and forth and negotiating with the companies, and I think it's clear, isn't it, that no one, whether it's campaigners such as yourself or the companies or indeed the regulator, is happy with where we are now. And I wonder then if you would recognise that there is what some people have called a doom loop, where these are underperforming companies. They don't have money from shareholders. In fact, Thames Water's shareholders have refused to fund fixing these problems, such as underinvestment in the whole water system. And somehow that needs to be fixed. Otherwise, we're forever going to be in this doom loop.
It's a situation, and let me be clear about this. It is one purely and specifically of the industry and the regulators making. And I, for one, am admonishing the idea that someone has got the gall to come and tell me that I must continue to support a failed system of regulation and operation. So the truth is, when companies talk about investment, from our analysis, little of any of it actually ever comes from the shareholders. Anyway, historically, it is always funded directly out of people's water bills. So if government is intent in having this review, I hope that it is a complete and utter root and branch of that failure of the regulatory system, and specifically looking at whether the current model of funding and structure and operation of these companies is capable of delivering for the future, because I'm not at all sure that it is. So, I think it needs a massive overhaul. Okay.
But right now, I mean, in that massive overhaul, where would the money you think realistically come from if you don't want it to come from customers' bills and the companies can't get it off their shareholders?
Well, in that case, we're going to have to look at a complete restructuring of those companies, because bearing in mind Ofwat has conceded and admitted, and the industry acknowledge it, they have a legal obligation to build and operate properly functioning sewage systems. And for 35 years, we've provided them with all of the funding that they needed to meet that obligation. Ofwat admits that. The companies now recognise that. So they're going to have to go back to their shareholders. They may have to go back and restructure their debt. But I think everybody is going to have to feel some pain in this right now. And all I see is more pain and more anguish and more debt being loaded onto customers, isolating the people who got us into this mess from having to feel some of that pain.
Okay. And it does look like there's an overhaul coming in that the government's due to announce plans this week that should lead to the setting up of a commission with a high-profile chair. Moment of hope?
There's all of these things. Devil is in the detail. Who's the terms of reference? Who's actually running it? And invariably, I have the words of Sir Humphrey ringing loudly in my ears. Is it a good chap that will deliver the outcome that we would like to see?
Fergal Sharkey, thank you.
13 minutes past seven now. Should this country send far fewer people to prison? That is the idea which seems to underlie a review of sentencing announced today. We'll be talking to the Justice Secretary about what she's got in mind at 10 past eight. One of those lobbying for a dramatic change of approach is the chief executive of the Howard League for Penal Reform, which wants fewer people in prison. She's Andrea Cooper. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
Should this sentencing review mark a real change in the country's attitude to prison?
Yeah, I mean, it really needs to. I think this morning, seeing the Secretary of State for Justice question whether prison works and having David Gawke appointed to head the Sentencing Council, who again has said that the prison's not working at the moment, is an important moment for us to reflect and be honest, I think, with the public about what prison can and can't do. And certainly prisons in the state that they are at the moment are simply not in a position to be able to deliver the kind of change for people's lives and turning people away from crime that I think the public expect of such an important public service.
It was Michael Howard, as Home Secretary, 30-odd years ago, said prison works, and his point was a simple one. If you're inside, you are not able to attack someone, to rob someone again. That keeps people safe.
I mean, it keeps people safe in the very short term, but of the 87,000 odd people in prison, all of them except 65 are returning to the community. So there are 65 people on whole life terms who are never coming out. Everyone else in prison is returning to the community, and we want them to return in a way that they are they're going to turn away from crime, to become good neighbours and good friends, co-workers, that they can be restored to citizenship in communities.
That's where you've got a job to do, though, isn't it? You've got to prove that the alternatives to prison work. And isn't the problem with that we often hear of problems reoffending? We hear people who are recalled having breached their licensing conditions because they drink or they take drugs or they don't stay at the place they were meant to stay, tags that are not fitted in the first place, all sorts of problems with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key problem, though, Nick, is that prison doesn't work. The reason we have higher reoffending rates is that people go into prison. At the moment, they're in their cells for 22, 23 hours of a day. They don't have the opportunities to retrain, to have education, to have the sort of psychological interventions that they might need or want to be able to move away from crime. So our key problem is that prison itself doesn't work. You're right. There are problems with some of the alternatives. I think that we have a crisis of confidence with sentences around certain community sentences, which were obviously savaged under the Grayling Transforming Rehabilitation agenda. And we have a probation service that is as full as the prison service is full, although probation doesn't get visibly full in the same way that prison gets visibly full.
Are you arguing that if you're going to do what you've long wanted to do, the money we save on building prisons, we will have to spend on better probation and better rehabilitation?
No question. You need to put the money, so take the £4 billion plus that's been committed to building new prisons, and instead put that into fixing up the current prisons we have, which are disrespectful of people places, and then sink that into probation and sink it into education and housing and the kind of things that we know do prevent crime. Because people get recalled because they're released from prison into homelessness. They're released from prison to no job. You know, that's how the current system works. So we set people up to fail. And we need to set people up to succeed. That's in their interest, but it's also in the community's interest.
And Andrea Coomber, Chief Executive of the Howard League for Penal Reform, thank you.
17 minutes past seven. America votes 2 weeks today. Although some people have already been casting ballots early, in person or through the post, on the day it'll come down to who gets a majority of electoral college votes, with each state getting a certain number of those votes. So I've been speaking to Kathy Frankovich, who works with YouGov America and is a former director of surveys at CBS News. I asked her first, possibly unfairly, to call it, or at least try to call it. How is the race looking right now?
Oh my, 2 weeks out, I would hesitate to say anything definitive. And that's partly because the polls suggest a very close race and have been saying that for, well, ever since Kamala Harris had entered the race this summer. I think that what we're seeing is a little bit of movement, perhaps, towards Donald Trump, but it's kept everything very even. If you average the polls, which is probably not the best way of looking at them, but if you average the polls, Harris has about a 1, maybe a 2-point lead in the popular vote. But as you may know, the popular vote in the United States is not the way you elect a president.
Yeah, and people will be, well, might know about some of the swing states, or certainly know that Pennsylvania is a really big and important swing state. What are the other states that UK listeners should be aware of over these next couple of weeks?
Well, you should be aware of two states that are close to Pennsylvania, Michigan and Wisconsin. Think of them as the northern part of the Midwest. And then two states in the South, that would be North Carolina and Georgia. And in the West, it's Arizona and Nevada. I should note that put together, these states have nearly 100 electoral votes and could very well be the determining factors. Most other states, if you name them, I could probably tell you where they will go come election night and who will take their electoral votes. But that gives nobody the majority. And he or she needs 270 votes, and they're going to come from these states.
Okay, electoral college votes. And where you have seen Trump doing better than before and edging away from Harris, better than Harris, why is that happening, would you say?
Well, this has not been a very dramatic election in terms of where people, popular movement. We have seen this close really ever since the beginning of this particular contest. But what's happening now is that people are focusing on the swing states and focusing on small groups of voters in those states. So Donald Trump has been appealing to men, and now not just white men, but also trying to appeal to black men. And he gained a bit in that demographic 4 years ago. And if he gains a little bit more, say if he wins 20%, that could make the difference in most of the states that I've mentioned.
And is the core problem, or one of the core problems for Kamala Harris, that she says my presidency will be different from Joe Biden's, but no one's quite sure what that means or how it's going to be different?
I think that's true, but I also think that she's really in a very difficult position. She is the sitting vice president. She has been part of an administration for 4 years. And while she has now said that her administration would not be exactly the Biden administration, it's hard to determine exactly where she would be different. And I'm not sure she would want to say anything specific that could, in fact, hurt her with people who still support Joe Biden and still wish that Joe Biden were the nominee.
And what's Donald Trump's biggest hurdle?
He has been doubling down on his hardcore supporters, his base, and that includes a lot of people, a lot of men, a lot of white men, a lot of people with less than a college degree, and doubling down on that, but doesn't seem to be reaching out towards other voters. For the most part, holding on to the people that he has.
Kathy Frankovich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is now almost 22 minutes past seven. Rachel Reeves, amongst others, will have been waiting for the latest figures on the government's finances, not least because she's got a budget to deliver in just over a week's time. Sean can tell her and us the news.
Yes, I suspect you might have looked at the PDF that's already come through from the Office for National Statistics, but I can tell you that borrowing for September came in lower than expected, still one of the highest on record. So the numbers being £16.6 billion borrowed rather than the £17.5 billion economists predicted. The Office for National Statistics saying that tax revenues brought in had increased, but debt payments, public sector pay rises had meant borrowing was higher than last year, both in September and also when you tot up the financial year all the way to September compared to last year. Andy King is a former senior official at the Office for Budget Responsibility, now a specialist partner at the consultancy Flint Global. Andy, what do you take from these numbers with a budget a week away?
Good morning, Sean. So I think the important number to look at is where we are halfway through this fiscal year, and borrowing's running ahead of the forecasts that were published in March. So it's not good news for Rachel Reeves. These numbers actually come too late to directly affect next week's budget, but they do tell us something about the tough decisions that we're hearing about. So revenue is doing a little better than expected, and that's probably because the economy is doing a little better than expected. But public spending is coming in significantly higher than predicted by bigger margins than revenue. And that's why borrowing's ahead of forecast. And the big story there is the spending on public services, which is billions of pounds above forecast. I know there's been some skepticism about the 22 billion black hole figure for this year, but if you just look at the run rate in the data, that figure looks quite plausible.
And how do these numbers tally with, you know, that other number that we've been hearing a bit more about this week or so, the £40 billion that the Chancellor may well be looking to raise in the budget next week?
Yeah, so these figures and something like the £22 billion tell you where the Chancellor's starting from this year. That figure of £40 billion, if it proves right, is the Treasury's estimate or the Chancellor's estimate of the funding gap in the medium term. And that's both a consequence of where she's starting, but it's also a consequence of the spending plans that she inherited. So she's trying to work out how much more she needs to spend to improve public services, to invest in public infrastructure, and how she can raise the money to pay for that.
Andy, thank you. Andy King there, formerly of the Office for Budget Responsibility, now at the consultancy Flint Global.
Sean, thank you very much. 25 past seven. How credible are allegations in Moldova that a referendum on closer ties with the EU was interfered with by Russia? That's been the charge of the Moldovan president, who did narrowly get a majority of voters to support EU accession. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, saw the voting take place.
At polling stations in Moldova, they were keeping it cheerful as the country voted not just for a president, but a political direction in a referendum that was supposed to turn Moldova definitively away from Russia and towards the West. The decision was on including EU membership in the constitution. Maia Sandu is the president who called that vote, and she's now calling what happened next a vile attack on democracy led from abroad. Because police here say they've uncovered a scheme to channel millions of dollars from Moscow to Moldova to pay for votes against Sandu and against the EU.
This was the EU referendum. This was a very close vote. You nearly lost it.
She only won the referendum by just over 13,000 votes. And the presidential elections will go to a second round. Maia Sandu told me other countries should take note.
What's not normal is to have a situation where criminal groups are bribing voters. Once these practices have been tried here, they might be tried in other countries. And we need to take seriously our democracies, and we need to learn from each other how to defend our democracies.
Are you blaming Russia directly? You talk about criminal groups and foreign
forces. Blaming the criminal groups who are using the dirty money to buy the Moldovan votes.
Here's a question.
It wasn't hard to find proof of that. At this polling station in a high school, my colleague saw a woman drop her ballot into the plastic box, then turn to an election monitor and ask where she could get paid. So outside, I asked her how much cash she was getting. 1,000 rubles, she told me, straight out. She wouldn't share who she'd been told to vote for, but she did say there were five people just in her group who'd all been bribed. She was only angry that the man who'd offered her money then disappeared. We were in the southeast, close to the border with Transnistria. That's the sliver of land that broke away from Moldova when the USSR fell apart. There are still Russian troops there. If they cross the border, Transnistrians still get to vote in national elections, and we found lots of them at the bus stop. I expected people to be staunch supporters of Russia, and some of them were. But there were plenty like Lera, a pensioner who told me clearly she was voting for the EU. She said she was fed up of being poor and just wanted to live like a normal person, like they do in Europe. So, as Moldova mulls over what's happened, it does seem entirely possible that the voting here was just as dirty as Maia Sandu has set out. In the end, a majority did choose the EU, but only just. And everything we saw suggests that Moscow isn't done here.
Sarah Rainsford reporting from Moldova. It's about to be 29 minutes past seven, and it's beyond time for the sports news. It's Simon Munden.
Certainly is. And we're starting with the news that Glasgow has been officially confirmed as the host of the 2026 Commonwealth Games. The scaled-back event will feature just 10 sports, including athletics, swimming, track cycling and netball. But the likes of hockey, badminton, squash, triathlon and rugby sevens all miss out. Our sports editor, Dan Rowan, joins me. Morning, Dan. Can you tell us, why has this event been slimmed down?
Morning, Simon. Well, it wasn't meant to be in Glasgow. The Australian state of Victoria was originally chosen to stage this event, but last year it withdrew due to escalating costs, plunging the game's future into doubt. Last month, the Scottish government said it would back a proposal for Glasgow to come to the event's rescue, but given the financial challenges it faces, only on the basis that it would come at no cost to the public purse, with the £114 million budget funded by compensation paid by Victoria to the Commonwealth Games movement after it pulled out. The last time Glasgow hosted the Games a decade ago, it cost more than £500 million, but organisers clearly felt that this time they had to scale it back to persuade the city to take it on again and to be able to prepare for it with so little time left. But I think it also aligns with the Commonwealth Games Federation's attempts to redefine the event, to make it more sustainable in a bid to try and attract future hosts. There was that memorable Games in Birmingham 2 years ago, which itself had to step in when Durban pulled out. But given the event's links with empire, scrutiny over the relevance of the Commonwealth, concerns over how much of a priority it is for some top athletes, there's long been debate about the game's future. Some believe this reduced format could revitalise it and save it as it approaches its centenary in 2030. But I think others may fear that the game's risks now being a shadow of its former self.
And how controversial do you think the exclusion of certain sports will be?
I think for some athletes and fans, very. I mean, take hockey, for instance. In Birmingham, England's women won gold. In Glasgow, they won't have that chance. They're one of nine sports that have been axed from the programme, as you said, along with the likes of squash, rugby sevens, cricket, diving, mountain biking, triathlon, all losing what's crucial exposure for their sports. There'll be major disappointment among those. There'll be no marathon or road cycling. Road race cycling, expensive but traditionally popular events that showcase a host city. Organisers will point to the 10 sports and the 6 para sports that do remain, such as athletics, swimming, track cycling, netball. They say that the quality of competition, the universality of participation and local appeal were all considered. The limited budget does mean just 4 venues will be used. Organisers say 500,000 tickets will be available, around 3,000 athletes from 74 nations and territories, which will help to deliver over £100 million of investment into the city, and some facilities will be upgraded. But, Simon, it was certainly going to look and feel very different to games of the past.
Yeah, it certainly will. Dan, many thanks. Some football lines for you in the Premier League last night. Nottingham Forest moved up to eighth in the table after they beat Crystal Palace 1-0 at the City Ground. The future of the Premier League is on the table at an emergency meeting later today when they'll be discussing those changes to financial regulations. Nick will have more on that shortly. And in cricket, all-rounder Liam Livingstone will captain England during their white ball tour of West Indies after Jos Buttler suffered a setback in his recovery from a calf injury. Butler's not played since the T20 World Cup in June and will miss the 3 one-day internationals in the Caribbean.
Simon, thank you very much. Let's look ahead to later this morning.
I'm James Gallagher and I'm back on BBC Radio 4 with Inside Health.
If we were looking at your overall brain health based on this, we'd give you a score of 74 out of 100.
Is 74 good?
74 is good, yeah.
Just checking.
We're looking at pioneering technology that's changing the lives of children with rare genetic diseases.
We get results back within 2 or 3 weeks that enable us to make a diagnosis and in some children offer life-saving treatment immediately.
I'll also be exploring the challenges of finding effective treatments for dementia and asking, how much do the shoes we wear affect our bodies? Inside Health is on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Tuesday mornings at 9:30.
Great look at the weather. Patchy rain for England and Wales this morning, turning drier later, showers in northern Scotland.
And here in the next half hour, police firearms officer who was on the scene as Chris Cabba was shot in South London 2 years ago gives us his reaction to his colleague being acquitted of murder.
And men and women who carry a gun in policing in the UK are volunteers. They can't be forced to do so. They do so for no extra money. They tend to be people like me, are motivated by making the right decision in incredibly high pressure, challenging situations. And they tend to be motivated by saving life.
And I can see John Cooper Clark looking at me down a lens. We'll be talking to him as well. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hassan and Nick Robinson. Time at 27 minutes to 8 for a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
At least 1,000 more prisoners are due to be released early in the second phase of government plans to tackle overcrowding in jails in England and Wales. Those being released will have completed at least 40% of their sentences. Ministers are also preparing to announce a review of prison sentencing led by the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawke. A man has died after two trains collided in Powys in what police described as a low-speed collision last night. A further 15 people were taken to hospital, although their injuries are not thought to be life-threatening. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken will arrive in Israel shortly to try to breathe life into the search for a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of hostages. The visit was arranged after the killing of the Hamas chief, Yahya Sinwar, which the Biden administration sees as a chance to revive peace talks. Meanwhile, Israel has maintained its bombardment of Lebanon. 4 people, including a child, were killed overnight in a strike outside the country's main hospital in Beirut. Hezbollah has also continued to fire rockets into Israel. Figures released in the last half hour show public borrowing stood at £16.6 billion last month. It's the third highest September borrowing figure on record. The BBC understands water bills will rise more than previously thought over the next 5 years, as the regulator Ofwat allows bigger increases to reflect higher costs and greater investment. The Clean Water campaigner Fergal Sharkey told this programme the proposals were a chaotic shambles, purely of the water industry and regulators' making. Separately, the government is due to announce plans this week that could lead to the biggest overhaul of the water industry since privatisation in the 1980s. King Charles and Queen Camilla, who are on the final day of their visit to Australia, have been visiting the birthplace of the country's Aboriginal civil rights movement in Sydney. A large crowd also welcomed the royal couple at the Sydney Opera House, where the King spoke to performers and members of the public.
Thank you, Jane. 24 minutes to 8 now. The most watched in the world, the wealthiest in the world, one of the country's most successful exports and sources of soft power. The Premier League really is the globe's premier sporting competition. But it's under threat, and it matters to the country whether you love or loathe football or are frankly indifferent to it. Last week on the programme, one of the founders of the Premier League, David Dean, told us harmony needed to be restored amongst the top clubs. I asked him whether the Premier League's position as the foremost league in the world was now under threat.
Absolutely. And we've got to always encourage investment, and we've got to make sure that the Premier League is the fastest train on the track. And we don't want anybody else trying to slow us down. If you've got major investors deciding, instead of investing in Premier League clubs, they decide to invest in La Liga or in the French League, it's important that we keep our number one spot.
The league's clubs have been summoned to a meeting today to try to agree the next steps to take in what looks like increasingly like a civil war between clubs owned by foreign billionaires and those owned by foreign multi-billionaires, between rich American businessmen and Arab states whose pockets are almost infinitely deep. A man who knows all about the Premier League is David Cogan. He's been on the programme several times. He negotiated media rights deals for the Premier League for more than 15 years. He's the co-founder of the Women's Sports Group and joins us in the studio. Morning to you. Thanks for coming to the Today studio. How different is the Premier League we're now dealing with, we're now talking about, than the one you dealt with just a few years ago?
Well, when I worked with the Premier League, it was still in the phase where clubs were owned by pretty big personalities, pretty big donors, pretty big individuals, but the common interest that served them all was the fact we were getting more and more money every 3 years from domestic and international media money. And actually, the principal source of revenue for all of the clubs in the Premier League were the deals that were being done in media rights. So actually, it was in a sort of their own self-interest to work collectively. There were rules governing voting within the Premier League, which still exists. You need a two-thirds majority for important decisions, 14 out of 60, out of 20 clubs. But fundamentally, despite the personality clashes off the field and battles on the field, the Premier League worked as a sort of coherent unit, driving its own value, and everyone signed off on it.
And is now the word, or the phrase, civil war, hyperbole, or do you think we are close to that?
Well, I think there are two problems that have occurred essentially with the Premier League's own success. Premier League's own success attracted a series of new types of owners, some of whom are associated with states with bottomless pockets, but also billionaires, as you said, from America, who own actually the majority of Premier League clubs. And they come from backgrounds where they look at their own individual self-interest. And the fact is that the Premier League has always had this inherent difficulty. It's been both the commercial arm of those clubs as a collective, but it's also been the regulator of those clubs. And the more individual clubs, such as Manchester City, but it's not just Manchester City, are trying to find their own commercial solutions to being global brands and global clubs, leaving the Premier League behind to an extent, the more that the Premier League's position as the person trying to manage them all, regulate them all, legally, is coming into conflict. And we've seen now the Premier League over the last 2 or 3 years in significant conflict with a number of its own clubs over its own rules.
David Dean, one of the founders of the Premier League, you just heard him there, says this means that the Premier League may no longer be the Premier globally in a few years' time. Is that overstated, or do you think that is a real threat?
I think David Dean is an extremely wise man who was a critical figure in the Premier League for a very long time. I think the problem about people always predicting the demise of football or football organisations is they forget that self-interest does tend to kick back in just at the moment when you think it's all going to go horribly wrong. But where things are different to David's time is that the Premier League was always the apex of ambition for most of those clubs. Today, even though the European Super League didn't happen, what you've got are clubs like Man City, the big clubs in the league, are now looking towards Europe, where Europe has extended its competitions. So the European Super League idea of creating super clubs in Europe is now being reinforced by UEFA and indeed by FIFA at a global level. So actually, big clubs more and more are looking outside of the Premier League for their future and their view as a global brand.
Now, I have deliberately not got into the detail of the legal battle that there is about whether Manchester City can get millions of pounds from an airline, for example, which it's alleged isn't a real sponsorship deal at all, or whether Arsenal, on the other hand, can take millions of pounds in free loans from its rich bagger. I've deliberately not got into that detail. Can it ever be resolved, though? It's all going through multiple legal cases at the moment. There's the Premier League, there's the prospect of a football regulator, which the government says it will bring in. Can this ever be solved?
Well, first of all, the Premier League is trying to amend its own rules in order to try and accommodate the case that took place with Man City a couple of weeks ago. But, of course, there's another very much bigger case looming involving Manchester City in the next couple of weeks. Can it resolve it? Quite difficult. with a government regulator coming in, act as a brake and as a differential factor? Probably it will, but we're waiting to see what powers that regulator has and whether it's going to be able to step into what is a more complex situation than a year ago when it was first being mooted.
And in a sentence, there is a row, a real row going on about the powers of that regulator, not just about the powers of the Premier League.
There is a debate, but there's also a row within the Premier League. Is the Premier League one league, or now is it two or three leagues? That's the real question.
David Cogan, thanks for joining us.
It is just after 20 to 8. What links Elbow, Stevie Nicks, Nicki Minaj and John Cooper Clarke, the poet known as the Bard of Salford? It is Manchester's Co-op Live, the UK's largest indoor performance venue with a capacity of more than 20,000. Because John Cooper Clarke has been booked to headline there next March. It's one of three events that he'll front to mark World Poetry Day 2025. And he's with us now. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
They're calling you the arena poet now, you know, because you are the first poet to headline a venue of this size.
Yeah, as far as I know, yeah.
How does it feel?
Well, I'm very excited to see how it pans out.
Well, are
like you?
You
say, it's
a first.
It's a huge venue, but it's purpose built for sound. So you know, unlike most arena gigs. This was actually built with music and performance in mind rather than it being some kind of, you know, converted ice hockey rink or, whatever. So, you know, it's a first in a lot of ways. I'm looking forward to it, obviously. The more the merrier.
Yeah. I wondered if you are starting to think any differently about an audience of that size, if you think,
think
that your show is going to be any different.
A mistake. I think that would be a mistake. I think poetry is a kind of it's a kind of intimate connection with the a sizable venue like that kind of mitigates against it. I think the best way to deal with this is just to do what I do in front of more and more people.
Yeah, more than 20,000 in this case.
Not really much you can change about what I do. You know, the dynamics are written into the poetry in my case. But, you know, I'm as interested as anybody else to see how it goes.
It does tell us something important and encouraging about the reach, not only of you yourself, but the reach of poetry and the spoken word and this kind of format, poetry live to audiences.
It's the best way that I know to convey poetry. I think poetry is a phonetic medium, actually. It's more at home in an arena than it is in a library because, you know, I think poetry should be received. You should hear it rather than, even if you were reading it yourself out of a book, you should read it aloud, I think. Yeah. And, of course, you can't do that in a library. People would tell you to shh.
Yes, whereas here, it's quite the opposite. Everyone wants to hear you. Quite the opposite in this case.
Yeah. I'll be making quite a bit of noise.
Are you going
the PA system and all? These four gigs I'm doing, they've added another one, actually, in at the Pavilion in Worthing on the 18th. Of March, and that they're also celebrate World Poetry Day, these four gigs.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I'm not doing these four gigs on World Poetry Day. Otherwise, I'd have to hire a helicopter. So it's over 4 days, but it's celebrating the annual phenomenon of World Poetry Day.
I
think poetry is something that everybody tries it at some point. Unlike most art forms, I think everybody gives it a go.
Why
wouldn't you?
Even writing it, or do you mean reading? Reading poetry?
Writing it. I think everybody gives it a go at some point. How difficult could it possibly be and all that? I think people write poems for the set pieces of life, you know, birthdays, engagements, weddings, Mother's Day. You know, the set pieces of life are often commemorated with a short rhyme.
And yet often after school, it leaves most people's lives, doesn't it? Or perhaps that is changing now.
I'm sorry, could you repeat
poetry,
that?
Poetry, I mean, you know, we're all taught it as part of what we learn at school. And then often it's not, you know,
people don't really recite poetry, or many people don't really recite poetry anymore, or remember great lines or lines they've loved, although perhaps that's changing.
Yeah, I'm sorry to cut in there, but excuse me, but we learned poetry at school, Michael Gove style. You memorised it, whether you understood it or not was irrelevant. You memorised the lyrics, and then maybe 30 years later, a couple of lines might strike you as being very pertinent to your life. It kind of creeps up on you, a lot of poetry. Well, but my poetry is a bit more immediate than the more cerebral stuff of the 19th century, I've got to say. So it's more amenable to a crowd.
Well, I hope you enjoy it, because you're certainly going to have a crowd, and tickets for the events are already on sale, certainly the one at Co-op Live in Manchester. John Cooper-Clarke, thank you.
Be a treat, won't it? 8:13. It is time for Thought for the Day. And this morning, joining us in the studio is Philip North, the Bishop of Blackburn. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning, Nick. There is a ketamine crisis on the streets of our towns and cities. In Burnley a few weeks ago, a 16-year-old boy fell into a canal and drowned, his friends apparently unable to rescue him. All were under the influence of ketamine. Since then, I've heard numerous accounts from clergy and community workers about the destructive impact that this drug is having on family life, especially in urban areas. Ketamine has legitimate uses, especially as a horse tranquilizer and in small doses as an antidepressant. But it is now rife as an illegal drug, often sold by children to children, with a street value that makes it cheaper than alcohol. I've heard heartbreaking stories from East Lancashire of parents in utter despair as they watch the drug take hold of their young people. But to tackle a problem like this, it's important to understand the causes. One GP described ketamine to me as a drug of escape. Heavy users talk about going into a K-hole, a profound dissociative state in which they step out of consciousness. For some, this helps with their depression or anxiety. Others describe hallucinogenic experiences in which they feel detached from themselves. Many ketamine users seem to feel a deep dissatisfaction with who they are. So a synthetic cocktail of chemicals is offering them a different or deeper meaning to their lives. Of course, a different, deeper meaning to life is what faith seeks to offer, because it provides a place in which people can wrestle with these complex issues around the purpose of life. One of the most captivating encounters Jesus has is with Nicodemus, a religious leader and a searcher who is intrigued by what Jesus has to say. Jesus points Nicodemus to the transcendent dimension of his life. You must be born from above, he says. His life is worth more than he believes. And Jesus offers Nicodemus a way to become more aware of his own identity as he comes to understand what a life lived in relationship with him might have to offer. Any response to the ketamine crisis needs to be multi-layered. It's good to see in the government's recently launched 10-year plan for the NHS a commitment to much improved treatment for drug and alcohol addiction. But it is also critical for them and others to offer ways in which young people can address these deeper questions of purpose. They need spaces and relationships in which they can explore their own value and worth. Because surely for our children, life is something that they should be delighting in rather than seeking to escape.
That was Thought for the Day with Philip North, the Bishop of Blackburn. It's now 8:10.
The system holding police to account is broken, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner Mark Rowley said, after one of his officers was acquitted of murder yesterday. The charge had been brought over the killing of 24-year-old Chris Cabba in September 2022 during a police vehicle stop. After the verdict, Sheeda Queen, Chris Cabba's cousin, said this.
Today, we are devastated. The not guilty verdict leaves us with a deep pain of injustice, adding to the unbearable sorrow we felt since Chris was killed. No family should endure the unimaginable grief we have faced since Chris was stolen from us. And this decision shows his life and many others like him doesn't matter to the system. Our son deserved better. The acquittal of Martin Blake isn't just a failure for our family, but for all those affected by police violence. Despite this verdict, we won't be silenced.
Well, the release of Martin Blake's name was one aspect objected to by many of his colleagues. I've been speaking to one whom we're not naming at his request, even though he has now left the force. At the time of Chris Cabba's death, he was in MO19, Specialist Firearms Command, and he was at the scene that night.
I arrived as shots were fired, and I witnessed Mr. Cabba being removed from the vehicle, first aid commencing on him, and then I played a role in the post-incident procedure that kicked in immediately on the moment the shots were fired.
What did you think or feel as you heard news of the verdict yesterday?
Listen, this whole case obviously hinges on the death of a man whose life was taken by the state, which is an incredibly serious, significant, momentous thing to happen. So I would like to offer my condolences to the family of Chris Cabba and indeed his friends. In terms of my own personal reaction, I guess there was a modicum of relief in the sense that it was trial by jury. And we know that juries can, to some extent, be slightly unpredictable. And the stakes clearly were incredibly high for Martin. That said, I wasn't surprised at the verdict. There was no kind of visible or audible glee by anyone I saw in the courtroom, anyone connected to policing or connected to Martin. There was just an acceptance that the right thing had happened and the right outcome had been achieved. There are no winners in this situation, and there were no winners in the courtroom yesterday.
Yeah, of course, it's not the right outcome as far as Chris Cabba's family are concerned, because they've called the acquittal of Mr. Blake not just a failure for the family, but for all of those affected by police violence. The fact is that he was unarmed, and there have been others in exactly that same position. Since 2005, four men who were unarmed at the point they faced armed police have been shot dead in non-terrorist operations. So when you look at figures like that, can you see why the family feel that the system doesn't reflect what they and others have gone through?
Listen, the family are grieving the death of a loved one. Again, I offer my condolences to them. In terms of this incident, and I will just talk about this incident, and I'll stick to the facts of the case as the court heard them. I don't feel well positioned to talk about the other cases that you mentioned. Firstly, I would say, Michelle, that this phrase unarmed, which is being used frequently in the description of this incident, is problematic in the sense that it implies Mr. Cabba was presenting no threat to the officers who were dealing with the incident on that night. And obviously the court heard something very different. And the case of the defence was essentially that Mr. Cabba was armed with a 2.5-ton high-powered Audi, which could absolutely have presented a lethal threat to the officers involved. So although Mr. Cabba didn't have a firearm at the time that he was shot, it is a problematic description to call him unarmed.
Is it your view that police should be outside the remit of the criminal law, that in instances of this kind, they should be subject to disciplinary and serious disciplinary procedures, but that the criminal law shouldn't apply? Because technically, under English law, they don't have special protections when using force. But, for example, as it happened in this case, their genuine beliefs and what they put forward about what they thought at the time is relevant.
This, again, is incredibly problematic, and there's no way we're going to do justice to this topic with the time we have this morning. I do think there's a tension there between the need for police officers to be partaking in the value of open justice that we have. I think it's important that they're viewed as fully accountable to the law and in front of the public. However, I would also say that there's a problem when police officers are scrutinised by people who don't necessarily understand the pressures and the issues involved. I'm no legal expert, but I do wonder whether there's something maybe akin to the court-martial system that we see in the military, which would be a better fit for incidents like this, where we have a panel of legal experts, a panel of subject matter experts who can call on witnesses from the incident itself, can call on further witnesses in a particular area to bring their expertise to bear, and that we can seek a kind of judicial outcome from that.
Yeah. But people like you and like the officer in this case, you are in a position of immense privilege and responsibility, aren't you, when you Absolutely. When you are among the very few police officers to bear weapons. Are you saying that any kind of criminal law charge, whether it is a manslaughter rather than a murder charge, you think would have been is inappropriate in all circumstances of this kind?
I think what officers most want, police officers who carry a gun, and by the way, Michelle, you're entirely correct to draw attention to the fact that it's a huge responsibility. And I will never forget the first time that I walked out onto the streets of London, or rather drove out in a vehicle with a gun strapped to my thigh. It felt incredibly significant. And I think they're the kind of emotions that we want our police officers to feel when they do step out with a gun.
But do you think everyone does? Did you ever see colleagues who you thought perhaps had gone into that role for the wrong reasons, or who you felt uncomfortable seeing them with weapons?
Absolutely not. I can only be entirely candid. I never saw that. I saw volunteers, and it's important to emphasise the fact that men and women who carry a gun in policing in the UK are volunteers. They can't be forced to do so. They do so for no extra money. They tend to be people like me who were, and in their case, often are motivated by making the right decision in incredibly high pressure, challenging situations. And they tend to be motivated by saving life, obviously far more than the eventuality that they may, in unwelcome circumstances, have to take life.
Was it wrong for this case over Chris Cabot ever to go to court?
I believe it was, yes. I believe that at no point was there any evidence that Martin Blake had done anything wrong, or at least deviated from his training or indeed the law. Martin is the most professional, assiduous, diligent police officer you will come across, and he should never have been put in this position. He was on Kirkstall Gardens that night on behalf of the state. The state put Martin Blake there that night, and the state trained him to do the fearsome thing that he had to do. And he should never have been named in the media. That's my personal opinion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, what's coming up on Radio 4?
I have more diamonds than the Queen of England.
Welcome to the world of thieves and hoaxers and con women.
She does sound fabulous, though.
Massive dogs, lots of cars.
But who are these lady swindlers? And did they get away with their frauds and deceptions by using their feminine characteristics?
I am the notorious Tilly Devine.
She's a bit of a one-off, really.
Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley.
Where true crime meets history.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
And the weather with Simon.
Michelle, thanks so much indeed. It's a relatively quiet day today. We've got some showery rain pushing its way south and eastward across England and Wales. It's currently around southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and through parts of northern England. Some of that rain is on the heavy side, but as it moves further south and eastward, it's just going to ease off really, and there'll be some sunny spells developing in all these areas. And then for southeast and eastern England, well, after a dry start with some sunny spells, we'll see a bit more cloud into the afternoon, the possibility of one or two showers as well. Maximum temperatures for England and Wales, 11 to 16 degrees. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, we've got some showers towards northern and western areas of Scotland, but those we're going to ease down, quite breezy, but sunny spells for most of Scotland and Northern Ireland, especially through this afternoon, and top temperatures of 11 to 13 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Assain and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 22nd of October. The headlines this morning, another 1,100 prisoners are to be released early as part of efforts to deal with overcrowding in jails in England and Wales. We'll speak after the news to the Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood. A man has died and another 15 people have been injured in a collision of two trains in Powys. Figures released this morning show that the government borrowed more this September than any other apart from during the pandemic.
And in the next half hour,
I feel confident that the Harris-Walz campaign will win, but I also feel very confident that it's going to come down to the wire.
President Trump is up at least by 1% in all the swing states, which is just huge.
We'll speak to those rallying for Kamala and for Donald in the US election with just 2 weeks to go. And before 9 o'clock...
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
I think she's got it.
I think she's got it.
The rain in Spain stays mainly...
My George has got it.
As my fair lady turns 60, we discuss how accents are viewed in society today. That's all after the BBC News, read this morning by Jane Steele.
At least 1,000 more prisoners are due to be released early as part of the government's strategy to ease overcrowding in jails in England and Wales. During the summer, prisons were close to reaching capacity and 1,700 inmates were freed early last month. Ministers are also preparing to announce a review of prison sentencing. It will be led by the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawk, who said the focus would be on moving the justice system out of crisis and towards a long-term sustainable future. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
About 1,100 inmates sentenced to 5 years or more are being freed. They are coming out having served 40% of their time rather than 50%, as was the case before the crisis with prison places in the summer. The government says those released won't include murderers, rapists and other serious sexual offenders, but drug dealers and fraudsters will be among them. Separately, ministers have appointed the former Conservative Justice Secretary David Gawk to lead a review of prison sentencing. Among issues he will look at is whether or not tougher sentences are required for crimes against women and girls and what can be done to tackle prolific offending.
With more details on the government's review into sentencing, here's our Home and Legal correspondent Dominic Casciani.
This sentencing review is aimed less at solving the current crisis and more at preventing it ever happening again. The government wants to reshape and redesign punishment with a focus on rehabilitation schemes that work and are specific to different types of offenders. The review will look at options for creating prison outside prison, including the case for sentencing some offenders to a modern form of house arrest monitored by technological advances in tagging. Officials also want to look at smartwatch-like devices piloted in some parts of the United States, which send messages to offenders to encourage them to comply with their rehabilitation program. The review reports back next spring, and any reforms could take a further year to deliver. Official projections, however, warn by that time the prisons could be full again if the government's emergency measures to manage the population fail.
The British Transport Police say a man has died and a further 15 people have been taken to hospital with non-life-threatening injuries following a collision between two passenger trains in mid-Wales. The First Minister of Wales, Eluned Morgan, said her thoughts were with all those involved. Our Wales correspondent Hol Griffith reports.
The trains collided near the village of Llanbryn Mair at around 7:30 on Monday evening. One was carrying passengers from Shrewsbury towards Aberystwyth. The other was travelling in the opposite direction from Machynlleth. A passenger who says he was on the second train has told the BBC he slammed into a table in the carriage as it stopped suddenly. He then went to help remove the driver from the mangled cab at the front of the train. Paramedics, the fire service, police and the Coast Guard were all called to the collision as both trains were evacuated. One person was killed and a further 15 people were taken to hospital with injuries which are not believed to be life-threatening. British Transport Police say they're investigating what happened leading up to the crash.
Government borrowing rose last month, marking the third highest September figure since records began in January 1993. New figures show that borrowing, the difference between spending and tax revenue, reached £16.6 billion last month. Here's our business reporter Ben King.
Labour has been warning that the public finances are in a poor state. And halfway through the financial year, borrowing is more than £6 billion higher than the Office for Budget Responsibility forecast back in March. Public sector pay rises and inflation pushed up central government spending in September, while interest payments on the national debt also rose. Tax receipts were higher than expected, but not by enough to outweigh that higher spending. Independent analysts had expected the figures to be worse. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, warned of difficult decisions and said the government needed to fix the foundations of the economy. Ministers are committed to covering all day-to-day spending from revenues, so today's figures underscore the pressure on the new Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, to raise taxes in her first budget next week.
Israel has maintained its bombardment of Lebanon. Four people, including a child, were killed overnight in a strike outside the country's main hospital in Beirut. Hezbollah has also continued to fire rockets into Israel. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is due to arrive in Tel Aviv shortly, his 11th trip to the Middle East since the start of the war in Gaza. The BBC's Tom Bateman is travelling with him.
This trip was rushed together in the hours after Israel killed the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, when the Biden administration saw a chance to revive the diplomacy. The chances of any immediate progress appear close to nil. The Americans acknowledge there is no one currently to negotiate with as Hamas figures out who its leader is to make decisions and whether it will return to the table. Instead, Mr. Blinken is likely to focus on proposals for governing Gaza if and when the war ends.
The BBC understands water bills will rise more than expected over the next 5 years as the regulator Ofwat allows bigger increases to reflect higher costs and greater investment. Separately, the government is due to announce plans this week that could lead to the biggest overhaul of the water industry since the late 1980s. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Customers are already angry that water bills are set to rise when water companies seem to have failed. Water companies say they can't raise money to invest in improvements without higher bills and are stuck in a doom loop, as the more they get fined, the less in the kitty to fix the things they're being fined for. Ofwat has to referee all this, and the BBC understands it will allow the water companies to raise bills over the next 5 years by more than the 21% on average they indicated in July. Numbers vary widely, but the increases in some cases, notably Thames Water, were less than half the rise they were asking for.
Vladimir Putin is shaking hands with leaders from top emerging economies ahead of the 16th BRICS summit in Kazan. The Russian president is hosting delegations from 36 countries, including more than 20 heads of state, among them the leaders of China, India and Iran. Here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
The Kremlin will urge member states to agree on a new cross-border payment system that is independent of the US dollar. But critics point to differences of opinion between BRICS members, even animosity. For example, India and China, Egypt and Ethiopia. What's more, Russia may have adopted an anti-Western stance, but some of the other BRICS nations, like India, are determined to remain on good terms, politically and economically, with Europe and America.
20 financial influencers, social media personalities who focus on money advice, have been interviewed under caution by the Financial Conduct Authority over the last week of concerns they've been promoting products illegally. The regulator has also issued 38 alerts against social media accounts which may contain unlawful promotions in what they're describing as a targeted action. England's health assessment body has said artificial intelligence has the potential to reduce the number of fractures and broken bones missed when doctors analyse x-rays. NICE, the National Institute for Care and Health Excellence, says the technology could be used to support the work of stretched healthcare professionals. King Charles has visited the birthplace of the Aboriginal civil rights movement on the final day of his Australian tour. The visit came a day after he was heckled in the country's parliament by an Aboriginal senator. Meanwhile, a prominent Indigenous activist who was shouting anti-monarchist slogans was arrested at the Sydney Opera House, where crowds were gathering to catch a glimpse of the royal couple later in the day. From Sydney, our senior royal correspondent Daniela Rell sent this report.
On the King and Queen's final day of engagements in Sydney, the crowds turned out in their thousands at the Opera House for the chance to chat to the royal couple ahead of a military review and a flypast. After yesterday's protest at the Canberra Parliament, a man was arrested close to the Opera House for shouting anti-monarchist slogans. Wayne Wharton is a well-known activist for Indigenous communities and has been at several events attended by the King and Queen in recent days. There were shouts of God save the King from royal supporters as he was arrested. Earlier, the King met doctors carrying out pioneering treatments for cancer in Australia and, with the Queen, attended a community barbecue where they were shown a number of different ways of making a sausage sandwich.
In the past hour, the stripped-back sports programme for the Glasgow 2026 Commonwealth Games has been announced. It includes track cycling, boxing and netball, but not hockey, squash, shooting or diving. Glasgow stepped in to host the Games after the Australian state of Victoria pulled out because of financial concerns. It's hoped this scaled-down programme will be more cost-effective.
Thank you, Jane. It's 8:10. Prison works, a Home Secretary famously declared 30 years ago, will today come to be seen as the day a Labour Justice Secretary says, oh no, it doesn't. Ever since Michael Howard made that statement, the prison population has soared. It's doubled in 30 years. This country now has the highest incarceration rate in Europe. Ever since, politicians have got applause and praise in the press for promising to lock people up, but not so much for spending money on actually doing so. In the last 14 years, just 500 extra prison places have been created. Today, therefore, for the second time in just a few weeks, more than 1,000 prisoners are being released early. And perhaps with much greater long-term significance, the Justice Secretary is announcing a review of who gets sent to prison in the first place. Well, delighted to say we're joined by the Justice Secretary and Lord Chancellor Shabana Mahmood. Good morning and welcome to the Today programme. Do you accept this is a day of shame for the British state? You may blame your predecessors for it, but this should never have happened.
It should never have happened. I was absolutely shocked to walk into the Ministry of Justice on the 5th of July and see the true scale of the disaster that had unfolded in our prison system. We were on the brink of collapse in our prisons. We were about to run out of prison places. In August of this year, just after the bank holiday, we were down to fewer than 100 places across the whole of the prison system in the whole of the country. That's a pretty shocking state of affairs. And it's clear that things have to change. We can't carry on as we are. Unfortunately, it's not possible to build our way out of this crisis because the demand for prison places is far exceeding the ability to catch up with supply. We will build more prison places, but sadly, they still won't be enough. So we do have to think about doing things differently. And that's why I've announced the sentencing review, because prison has a place, people have to be punished, and we have to do better on reoffending and reducing reoffending as well. We have to do things differently if we're going to prevent the sort of disaster that faced me when I walked into the Justice Department in July.
Well, let's come to those big questions about the balance between building more prisons and sending fewer people to prison in just a moment. But before we do, let's talk about the immediate measures that are being taken today. This is the second mass early release programme carried out under this Labour government. So people are asking questions about how the first one went. A few quick-fire questions, if I could. Can you tell us how many of the people you released last time have reoffended?
Well, we will publish the statistics on reoffending and recalls to prison in the usual way. I won't get ahead of those statistical
when
releases.
When would that be?
I believe the next set of figures are before Christmas.
We're entitled to know now, as you release another 1,100 people, whether people have reoffended or been recalled on.
Well, you'll appreciate when people are charged with further offences, there's usually a process, a trial. People have to be convicted of a further offence before we know that that counts towards the reoffending number. So there is always a lag in these stats, and they are, statistical assurance has to take place in the normal way, and I don't want to get ahead of that. What I will say is that looking at just our internal data and our assessment of what's happening across the system, the rates of recall and reoffending for the emergency releases that have taken place in September and that are taking place today are broadly tracking similar to what we would expect to see with usual releases, as it were.
In Scotland, so it's more than one in 10 who were let out early who have been taken back to prison because of reoffending. Is that roughly the rate we're talking about?
No, the rates, I think, are tracking similar to usual releases. The rates
around
of recall,
about...
well, I would say, look, the rates of recall are very high. We've seen a huge increase in the recall population.
Just to explain to people, recall is different from reoffending. In other words, recall is where you breach your licence. And we heard from the Chief Inspector of Prisons on File on 4 here on Radio 4, about half of the people that you release are having to be recalled because they've technically breached their licence.
Well, look, I don't believe it's as high as 50%, but I'm not going to get ahead of statistical releases that are due to take place in the usual way in just a few weeks' time. The rates of the fundamental point here, though, is that the rates of recall are very high, and that is true. And the issue here is people are released on licence. They have strict licence conditions that they have to abide by. If they break those licence conditions, it is right that they are recalled to prison. So actually the rates of recall and the fact that people are being recalled shows that the system is working as it should. When these emergency releases or usual releases from prison are taking place under licence, they are under licence. You know, you're not just out and free, you're serving a licence, you have to stick by those conditions. But if you break them, you are recalled to prison.
Can you confirm, though, this morning that you are in fact extending early release and you're going to reduce the recall rate. You are going further than the announcement that we've already seen of these 1,100 people being released today, so that people will be able to leave jail up to 12 months early if they agree to wear a tag.
No, I think, look, I'm going to make some further announcements about operational measures later in the House today. I won't get ahead of that in the media round this morning, but there will be no further emergency releases of the type we have seen. The last Conservative government had their scheme. It was called ECSL. It was not very transparent, didn't give the probation service any time to prepare. The scheme that I was forced to bring in was very different to the last Conservative government's, but both are a type of emergency release that I never want myself or any other Lord Chancellor to be in the position of having to do again. And that's why we're doing the sentencing review, because emergency releases can never happen again.
Justice Secretary, you know, I know there are times and places to announce one, but if you're appearing on the radio on the day that you're releasing a lot of prisoners, it seems to me right to confirm or deny that you planned. Danny Shaw is reporting this, our former correspondent, well known to you. I know he's advised Labour ministers on the issue of criminal justice, that prisoners will in future be able to leave jail up to 12 months early on a tag on a scheme that you are about to announce.
No, I believe the scheme that maybe Danny Shaw is talking about is an already existing scheme called Home Detention Curfew. But look, I'm not going to get
ahead. 6 months now and it's going to be doubled.
I'm not going to get ahead of any further announcements that will take place in the House later. I'll be very happy to come back on your programme and discuss further measures anytime, Nick.
Understood. We will take it from the fact you make the announcement in the House that you have something to announce, and it is almost certainly that. But I understand that the rules are the rules. Let's turn then to the wider philosophy here. Was my opening introduction fair, that Michael Howard, the former Conservative Home Secretary, said prison works, and you're in effect saying, no, it doesn't?
Well, prison should work. My position on this is that prison is an important part of how we punish offenders, people who've broken the laws of our land. But nobody could say, if you look at the status quo at the moment, that prison is working right now. And partly this sentencing review is designed to make sure that prison does work in the future. At the moment, our prison system creates better criminals rather than better citizens. 80% of all offenders are re-offenders, and 90% of those who are sentenced to custody, who have to serve time in prison, are also re-offenders. It's a pretty shocking state of affairs. And I think, we have to have a long-term plan that gets us in a different position, where prison has a place and it works, keeps the public safe, but also where we do better at rehabilitating offenders as well. In the end, that's good for the offender because they get the chance to turn their life around, but it's also a strategy for cutting crime. When you look at the rates of reoffending, they are sky high and they do need to come down.
Don't you have to prove that the alternative to prison also works? Now, we know that after the last prisoner release programme, the early release programme, that the company Serco had to be fined because lots of prisoners were not fitted with the tags they were meant to have after they left jail, because there weren't enough tags. You won't get public confidence if you can't do the basics right, will you?
Well, just on a point of fact, actually, there are enough tags. The issue with Serco has been their performance on the contract and not having enough staff to fulfil their obligations under that contract. But there are enough tags. There were enough tags with the last set of releases. There's enough tags now. So the availability of tags is not the
problem. Listeners won't care who didn't have the tags and why. They just think people should have been tagged and they weren't.
Yes, and look, Serco's performance has been unacceptable, and they've been hearing that from me, my ministerial team and my officials pretty much every single day. We've seen some improvement. We won't hesitate to take more action if it's needed. We've already levied financial penalties. So we are monitoring that closely. But let me address the broader point, because one of the principles of the sentencing review, in addition to making sure we've always got prison places for those who need to be locked up, we need to encourage people to rehabilitate and turn their back on a life of crime. But we do also, and you are right about this, we have to expand the use of punishment outside of prison. And I'm very clear that that has to maintain the confidence of the public. People still have to know that you are being punished for breaking the laws of our land, even if you're not serving time in custody, that there are real consequences, that you really feel the loss of your liberty still. And we have at the moment a range of technology that we use in order to supervise, monitor offenders when they're not serving a sentence in prison.
Yeah,
that,
so
includes tags,
in yeah.
That includes tags. They do work. We actually have a good performance rate on tags. Sobriety tags, for example, which monitor whether somebody is staying off alcohol or not, actually have a 97% compliance rate. What I want the review to look at is the technology we have available to ourselves at the moment and whether we can go further with that. And also, what is the new emerging technology that other countries are using that we might be able to adopt in this country?
If you can do this, if you can use what I guess most people would see as like being a smart watch to ensure that people are at home or they're not taking drugs, they're not taking alcohol, that they're maintaining a curfew and so on and so forth, can we be clear where this is heading? It is heading to you wanting to have fewer people in prison and to build fewer prisons, not more.
Well, again, Nick, the reality is that we are going to see an increase in prison capacity because we are going to build the 14,000 places that the last Conservative government failed to do. So you'll see an increase in prison capacity. You'll see an increase in the prison population as well. The truth is, though, we can't build our way out of this crisis. And that's why we've got the sentencing review. But you are going to see prison capacity and the number of prisoners in our system go up for a period. This is about managing.
For a period. Let's be clear. Let me just make this clear for people. Are you saying that you want to curb the speed of increase of the prison population? In which case, frankly, Secretary of State, you're not changing very much at all, are you? Just making the budget add up. Or are you actually saying this is a new approach? I want fewer people to be incarcerated in Britain. I do not want us to be the European leader in locking people up.
Well, the problem is that the rate of increase is such that nobody can keep up with demand and you risk running out of prison places, which goes right back to the inheritance that I was handed when I walked into the Justice Department. We are in danger of running out of prison places. We reach critical capacity again by next summer. We cannot build our way out of this crisis. To put it in context, you know, I have HMP Birmingham in my constituency. That's a very large, older Victorian prison, has a capacity of over 1,000. We need to build nearly five of those every single year to keep up with demand. So we do have to manage demand into the prison system. But for a period, it's obvious that demand is going to go up because we are going to have to build those 14,000 places. If we don't, we run out of prison places earlier than we would expect. So the crisis is so acute that all of these things, building more supply, dealing with demand, they have to be part of the solution. But in the end, the sentencing review is our best opportunity to set a new trajectory where we can manage that demand, where I can make sure we never run out of prison places again, where there is a prison place for everyone who needs to be locked up, and where we expand the range of punishments outside of prison
as
well.
And the Treasury are clearly saying to you pay for it. Because you wrote to the Prime Minister over the head, behind the back, you give me the description, of the Chancellor of the Exchequer to say, I need more money than Rachel Reeves is prepared to give me in the budget. It's simple, this. They're going to say, save the money by building fewer prisons. Get on with it. Do it faster. Don't send so many people to prison. Pay for more probation officers and more tags yourself.
Well, look, I'm not going to comment on anything to do with the budget process. The Chancellor will make her statement next Wednesday. I'll be happy to discuss all of those details once that statement has been made. But look, we have committed to and we will deliver the 14,000 places that the last Conservative government failed to build. They had a 20,000 prison building programme. They only delivered 6,000. We'll deliver the rest. Okay. But it still won't be enough. I guess that is the critical point here. Nobody can build fast enough because you need nearly five HMP Birminghams every single year just to keep up with demand into the prison system.
So we have to do something differently. We've got to let you go, Justice Secretary. I have one final thing, if I can. When you make this announcement in the Commons, I'm told that what it will mean is that an offender sentenced to 36 months and then released 40% of the way through their sentence under existing rules could only spend 2 months in jail. Is that right, that someone who could be sentenced for 36 months might only, under these reforms, spend 2 of those months in jail?
No, I don't recognise that characterisation, Nick. And I think there is a conflation of the way that different measures potentially interact with one another. As I say, I'll be making further announcements in the House later today. I'll happily come back on your programme to discuss the detail of those.
Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood, thank you for joining us.
25 past eight. While some Americans are casting votes early, Election Day itself is now exactly 2 weeks away. Harris versus Trump is entering its final phase, and all the evidence is of an incredibly tight race. Money matters, of course, spending on ads and the big rallies. But the campaigns also have their grassroots efforts, especially in key swing states. I've been speaking to two people battling for the campaigns in such places. First, Debbie Patel, who's been on the streets of Wisconsin for Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party.
In Wisconsin, we are used to razor-thin margins in every election. For example, in 2016, Donald Trump won the state with fewer than 20,000 votes. And then in 2020, Joe Biden won with less than 20,000 votes. I guess what I'm saying is that we're used to nail biters. We know we're in a nail biter election. And I feel confident that the Harris-Walz campaign will win. But I also feel very confident that it's going to come down to the wire. And that's why we're working as hard as we are.
Do you think it's going to be as tight as close as 2016?
Do you know, I don't trust the polls. At this point, we don't trust the polls. And we, because of our past experience, we are assuming it's going to be that close. And that motivates us to go out and get every vote, get every voter that we want to get to the polls, to get them to the polls. That's why we are working so hard. And there's thousands and thousands of us around the state.
What are the questions, Debbie, about Kamala Harris that you hear that are hardest for you to answer? Where is she most vulnerable?
Where is she the most vulnerable? I think the answer to that is that she is less known. And so people are just getting to know her. And because the vice president doesn't always have as visible a role, people want to know what her positions are. And when they, the more they learn about her, what we found when we talked to voters, and we've actually been talking to voters, we started talking to voters in the spring when Joe Biden was still on the ballot, but that talking to voters hasn't stopped. And then after Kamala Harris became the candidate, obviously, then we started asking them questions about issues and talking them about Kamala Harris's views. I think the things that the voters are most interested that we hear about is, as you probably know, a woman's freedom over her body is a huge deal in America, that the Trump and his MAGA colleagues want to control the bodies of one half of our population. They're very concerned about healthcare protections. They are concerned about whether they might lose Social Security. There is a concern about whether our families are safe. So those are the issues that we find the voters want to talk about. And then we have this thing in America that your listeners may not know about, but there's something called Project 2025, which is Trump and the MAGA blueprint for how they want to move forward if he gets into the White House.
But if Kamala Harris's key vulnerability is that she's less known, do you blame Joe Biden, at least in part, for that? He was forced to step down late in this race.
I don't. I you know what? I'm not going to go there. I'm just not going to go there. It happens, and it happened the way it happens. And let's put it this way. It's so far above my pay grade that I don't give it any thought.
Debbie Patel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, Melanie Collier, who's a Republican, has been volunteering and canvassing for the Trump campaign in the swing states of North Carolina and her home state of Georgia. Here's what she told me.
We're up, and I'm feeling very good about it. Right now, across the board, President Trump is up at least by 1% in all the swing states, which is just huge. This time in 2016, he was down about at least 10 points, depending on which state it was. And so if you look at where we were then and what the win was at that time versus where we are now, things are looking very, very good.
You don't think, Melanie, that some people who were minded to vote for him might have taken stock again after some of the odd things that happened in the last week or so? For example, the rally where he stood swaying on stage to music for about 40 minutes. Did that not make you wonder?
No.
What do you think was going on?
Well, I'm trying to think which rally that was. There's so many that take place. It's just Trump being Trump. I mean, if he's on stage, he's going to do what he wants to do. And apparently, I don't think it was 40 minutes. It probably was much less than that. But I think that he was just going with the music. There's not much more to say than that.
And the other day, more recently, when he appeared to be talking about the golfer Arnold Palmer and how his body looks coming out of the shower?
Well, he's going to say some things that are not the most, that are not standard for what other politicians through the years have talked about. But right now, I know that he's confident that he's in the right place, and he's just Trump being Trump, but he's on his way to a huge win.
So when you go out and when you talk face to face with voters, when you try and change people's minds, do they bring up instances like that?
Not often. I mean, there's very rarely, in fact, that I ever hear anything like that. Right now, the people that I talk with are seeing what has happened with our economy. They see what has been the result of the last 4 years of the Biden-Harris administration. And she was very much an active part of what took place during these 4 years. And we're in some of the worst shape we've been in years and years and years. And they want Trump back because they want to go back to what his policy stood for and what they basically their way of life while he was in office. So right now, it doesn't take much to talk somebody into voting for Donald Trump right now.
The Harris-Biden campaign presidency had to bring the economy back from COVID, of course.
Well, you can say that, but that's really minor compared to what the things that were in place when they came into office and the orders that Biden did the minute he walked in and just basically rescinded everything that Donald Trump had in place that was working. He destroyed. And so in the process, he and Kamala Harris have destroyed the economy. They're working really hard to destroy the whole country. And we are very aware that leaders around the world don't have much respect for what is going on with the Harris-Biden administration. And they know that when Donald Trump comes back, he's a professional. He knows what he's doing, and he is going to be it'll be a new day when he comes back, one that we're all looking forward to.
Melanie Collier, thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Take care.
And from that to the sport with Simon Mundy.
Thank you. This morning we found out that Glasgow has been officially confirmed as the hosts of the 2026 Commonwealth Games. Scotland's most populous city last hosted the event 10 years ago in 2014, and they stepped in to host after the Australian state of Victoria pulled out because of rising costs. The scaled-back event will feature just 10 sports, including athletics, swimming, track cycling and netball. But the likes of hockey, badminton and squash all miss out. So how much of a hit is this decision to sports like those? Well, we can speak to the former squash world number one, Nick Matthew. Now, good morning, Nick.
Morning, Simon.
The World Squash Federation released a statement this morning saying they are deeply disappointed with this decision. How did you feel when you first heard the news?
Yeah, absolutely. I think squash has been a massive part of the Commonwealth Games since 1998 now, and one of its core sports, actually. So I guess with that comes, you believe, there's a little bit of security for the future of the event. But landscape moves quickly in sport, doesn't it? And rather than being part of 22 sports going to Victoria, it's now 10 in Glasgow. So as you said, things have been stripped back.
Now, you won 3 gold medals in your time at the Commonwealth Games, including in Glasgow 10 years ago. How do those wins rank in terms of the titles you picked up during your career?
Oh, absolutely. It was the pinnacle at the time. It was before squash's inclusion in the Olympics, and the Commonwealth Games was, alongside a world championship, was the biggest thing. I have fond memories of Glasgow. It was a crazy time. I had knee surgery a few weeks before and didn't think I was going to make it. My wife was pregnant with our first baby, and I got honoured with being the flag bearer in the opening ceremony. So it was crazy, crazy times, but amazing memories, and such a shame we can't replicate them this time around.
Yeah, as you mentioned, after years of lobbying, squash only recently found out it would be included in the Olympics for the first time in 2028 at Los Angeles. So does that make this news about omission from the Commonwealth Games any easier to take?
I guess it softens the blow. There's no doubt about that. You know, it's always been a big goal of mine to be able to go into a school, a primary school kind of level, and say that you can win an Olympic gold medal at this sport. That kind of resonates around the world. But of course, the Commonwealth Games, we've got such history, such sort of heritage and tradition in that event. So, you know, I hate the feeling of being in one but not the other. To me, all of the different global games like the Commonwealth, the Asian Games, the Pan American are all just on that slight tier just below the Olympics as the pinnacle, and they all should be that sort of amazing showcase of all the sports before we go to the Olympics every 4 years.
And just finally, Nick, will this impact up and coming squash players at all or much?
I think, as you said, we have got that silver lining with the Olympics. I know the players in my academy in Sheffield are all sort of working towards that 2028 goal in LA. However, probably two players from each country going into that one. So it does mean that sort of funnel gets a little bit narrower, and there won't be perhaps as many people getting things like funding to help support them to the next level. So it might have that trickle down effect.
Nick Matthew, thank you very much for speaking to the Today programme. And just one football line. It was a frustrating evening for Crystal Palace last night. An error from their goalkeeper, Dean Henderson, allowed Nottingham Forest to snatch a 1-0 win. They're up to eighth in the Premier League, and Crystal Palace are third bottom of the table, still without a win this season, Nick.
Not a good season for them so far, is it? Simon, thank you very much indeed. Coming up just after nine, Young Again.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Young, and today on Young Again, I'm in conversation with the actor and comedian Miranda Hart. We'll be talking about lots of things, including the past traumatic decade. I'll be asking her what advice she'd give her younger self.
I feel sad looking back that part of my younger self, which was only 10, 15 years ago, couldn't fully embrace it and enjoy it because she was just cracking on.
Yes.
As, you know, I was beginning to feel more unwell and had to be the professional.
Join me this morning at 9 for Young Again on BBC Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds.
And Kirsty Young is going to be one of our guests on the Today podcast this week with Amol and me.
The weather, patchy rain for England and Wales this morning, turning drier later, showers in the north of Scotland.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Essain and Nick Robinson at 23 minutes to 9. Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Around 1,100 prisoners are set to be released early from jails across England and Wales as part of the government's strategy to ease overcrowding. Separately, ministers are set to announce a review of prison sentencing, which the Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood told this programme was about taking a different approach because she said the government couldn't build its way out of the crisis. A man has died after two trains collided in what police describe as a low-speed collision in Powys, Wales. 15 people have been taken to hospital. Their injuries are not thought to be life-threatening. The BBC understands water bills will rise more than previously thought over the next 5 years. It comes as the government looks at rolling out plans that could lead to the biggest overhaul of the water industry since the late 1980s. King Charles has wrapped up his Australian tour by visiting the birthplace of the Aboriginal civil rights movement in Sydney, a day after being heckled in the country's parliament by an Indigenous senator.
Jane, thank you very much. It is coming up to 20 to 9. The British-Egyptian writer and activist Ali Abdel Fattah remains in jail in Cairo, despite now serving the 5 years he was given for spreading fake news. He had shared a Facebook post about a death in custody. His mother, Leila Swaif, has come to London in the hope of getting the British government to do more to secure his release. She has been on hunger strike since the 30th of September. That is the day of the 5 year mark being passed. And she's with us in the studio now. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm okay so far. Nothing dire has happened to me. That's what happens when you're on hunger strike. You get 5 days of severe hunger, and then you get it varies from person to person, maybe 20 to 30 days where you're okay because your body is burning all the surplus fat. And then the problems start, that can lead to very dire consequences.
And you've driven...
I'm still not in that stage. I hope not to arrive at it, but I don't plan to break my strike or eat anything until my son is released.
And you've been driven to take this very extreme step because of his continuing detention. He is today probably Egypt's best-known political prisoner. Now, your daughters did manage to see the foreign secretary.
They did.
Are there any signs of Britain stepping up its call?
Not as far as we can see. I mean, everyone is nice, the foreign secretary, the ambassador, the Minister of State for our area. Everyone is nice. Everyone is supportive verbally, but nothing is happening. Nothing is happening. And when the foreign secretary was shadow foreign secretary, he said clearly, he said on this program, that there were things that could be done, leverage that could be used.
For example, restricting the Egyptian ambassador to London's access in diplomatic or official circles.
Yes, and I had hoped, now that he was actually a foreign secretary, that this would happen. Nothing has happened.
Do you believe that it is within the British government's power to secure Ali's release?
Yes, because, you see, this is not like the situation with Iran or with Afghanistan or with China. These governments are friends. Egypt is an ally of Western governments. It's an ally of England. You've got trade deals. You've got many things going for you. So, really, they should be able to work something out. These are friends, and Allah is the responsibility of both governments. So, if I see Mr. Lamy and the Egyptian foreign minister taking a photo, smiling from ear to ear, this means relationships are good. And if I don't see movement on my son's dossier, I must assume that the British government is complicit in some way.
The statement we've had from the Foreign Office says, our priority remains securing consular access to Mr. Al-Fatah and his release. We continue to raise his case at the highest levels of the Egyptian government. You saw your son, I think, in Cairo
fairly recently. Yes, I see my son once a month, at least.
Once a month. And how was he the last time you saw him? How's he coping?
He's okay. He's coping on a day-to-day basis because now he's after all the campaigning we did, the best thing we could secure is better prison conditions. So he's got books, he's got sports TV. So he's coping on a day-to-day basis. He can keep himself entertained. But he's really not, he's down, he's not hopeful. He will not speak of the future. If pushed, he would say things like, you'd better assume that Khalid is an orphan. Khalid is his son. You'd better assume that Khalid is an orphan and make your plans for that. But he cheers himself. He was cheered by the news of, he's cheered by the news of his sisters, by particularly Mona, that's my oldest daughter, because she's had a child and she's finally gotten a good job. And so he's cheered by that. That kind of thing helps.
Are you really going to not eat until he's released?
Absolutely. Anyone who knows me personally knows I don't bluff. If I say I'm not going to eat, then I'm not going to eat. And if the only thing it takes is a crisis precipitated by me being carried into hospital, dying, to get Allah out, I don't want to do that. I do not want to leave my children with the memory of a martyred mother. But I will do that if it's necessary.
You must feel the effect on your body already.
It's still very minor, but I know that eventually it will happen unless something is done quickly.
Leila Swaif, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
It's 16 minutes to 9. More prisoners are going to be released early today, 1,100 more serious offenders. And although the Justice Secretary told us she would not preempt an announcement made in Parliament this afternoon, more prisoners beyond that will be released early. They'll be allowed to leave prison a year early if they agree to wear a tag. That's double the current 6 months. That is what, in the language of Yes Minister, would be described as brave, not least because the media often run headlines encouraging a mentality of lock them up and throw away the key. Well, I've been discussing about what the government will now face, the political difficulties, the media difficulties, with Kirsty Buchanan, former number 10 of Ministry of Justice Special Advisor, who's now director of the political consultancy Stonehaven, and David Yelland of the When It Hits the Fan podcast here on Radio 4, and the former editor of The Sun.
She's doing something very interesting, Nick. She's leaning into a crisis. Of course, they know what the reaction is going to be. They know what the tabloids and the rest of the press are going to say tomorrow. They know how the country is going to react. Very similar to me to the decision the FA took last week to appoint a German to run the England football team. You know, they knew the reaction to that too. But you know what? If you're going to get things done, you cannot focus group your way through these things. You have to actually lean into a crisis and say, OK, it's going to be very difficult, but it has to be done.
Kirsty, when you were in the Ministry of Justice, the very issues that I've been discussing with Shabana Mahmood, the current Justice Secretary, must have been on your table, in the briefing documents, in the conversations you had. Was it just too hot to handle?
No, excuse me, not at all. Look, so when we were there, actually, we took a deep dive into what the greatest drivers for prison growth were. People may be reassured to know that this isn't that we're just locking up more people and throwing away the key. The greatest driver since the 1990s isn't, and it also isn't a sort of tit-for-tat arms race among politicians desperate to be seen to be, you know, tougher on crime than the next person. The greatest drivers are an increase in reporting and convictions for serious sexual offences. So that's rape, domestic violence, rape of a minor and robbery. So they're all violent crimes. And actually, we are sentencing more people for those, and we are sentencing them for longer. The prison population itself has remained relatively stable since about 2010, around 85,000. But between the sort of 1990s, the huge surge, that extra 20,000 people that we sent to prison, I think we can all agree really need to be there. They are very serious offenders. That is what has driven the increase in the prison population.
And David, the surge, particularly in those categories of serious offenders, is what readers, viewers, listeners are often demanding of the people who write headlines.
That's right. But the problem here is that the media, and I, you know, obviously used to edit one of these papers, they don't want to look under the bonnet. The public doesn't want to look under the bonnet. Nobody wants to look at the detail. And what has happened in recent years, without being too political, is that basically the prison estate has just been left without proper investment. You can see that throughout the whole of the estate. It's quite obvious. But I thought the Justice Secretary dealt with, you know, earlier on when you were interviewing her, you know, she clearly knows that this is very controversial. She is on top of the detail.
Kirsty, answer the charge that, well, yes, you believe and Conservatives believed when in office that there were people who ought to be locked up. You weren't prepared to spend the money on actually locking them up.
The Ministry of Justice's own figures estimate that by 2027, the prison population will rise to 100,000. We're roughly at sort of 87,000 now. Let's see if in the next 2 years you can build those prison places to be able to do it. Like everything else in this country, building things is an inordinately difficult process. One of the reasons the Labour government quite rightly wants to go through wholesale planning reform, because it is inordinately difficult to build things.
Was that the problem though, or was the problem an unwillingness to spend the cash?
No, this is capital spend. It's not revenue spend. It is actually largely was driven by the complexities of our planning system, I can assure you. The other interesting thing about this debate that has been is interesting to hear David say she's leaning into the crisis. One of the interesting things that isn't being mentioned here is the impact this will have on the probation service. I absolutely agree our prisons are in crisis. I absolutely agree that violence is at a record high and that overcrowding is appalling. But our probation service is also in meltdown. And with this review, it looks like there might be a move towards a blanket removal of short-term sentences. One of the reasons that prolific offenders are sentenced to prison, even for short periods of time, 5 months, 6 months, is because judges themselves have lost trust in the community punishment because our probation system is in meltdown. It's not a version of prisons are really expensive and community punishments work better, so that's fine. Community punishments, if you do them properly, are really expensive too, and that will require huge levels of investment. And the potential consequence for public of saying house arrest is a viable alternative to prison it seems to me like it's going to erode public confidence. Netflix arrest.
Let's have a last thought on that from the man who studies all this. I know you've got to go and record your podcast in just a second, David Yellen. But people might think that because of the decline of papers like the one you used a long time ago to edit The Sun, the politics has changed. There's a Labour government, there's not a Tory government. The politics in reality hasn't changed on this at all, has it?
The politics has not changed, Nick. And also, although the media has changed, populism as a force in the country has become more potent. You can see it on social media, you can see it on certain, on GB News and elsewhere. And actually, populism, you can manage that in the previous era much more easily, actually, because you just had to call up me and the editor of the Daily Mail when I was at The Sun, and you could sort of have a conversation. You cannot have a conversation with the social media world. So they are going to be pummeled in the next 24 hours, but it is necessary for them to be pummeled. And I do think we need to remember that when people say, look, this government's terribly unpopular and so on, which they will say and continue to say, it may be because they're doing necessary things rather than just trying to win headlines in the short term. Because, we have had an era when we've had journalists in Number 10. And now we have someone that was a prosecutor in Number 10. And I think that is the difference, really, isn't it?
David Yellen, presenter of When It Hits the Fan here on Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds. Kirsty Buchanan, former special advisor at the Ministry of Justice in Number 10. Thanks for joining us.
8:09. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinian children, teenagers and university students in Gaza had their education abruptly ended after the Hamas attacks on Israel and the subsequent war. How or if a generation of young people will catch up with what they've lost is not known. But at the Edward Said Conservatory for Music, there is an effort to restart teaching, including to children with life-changing injuries. John Donison, who visited the conservatory when it was still standing before the war, reports.
In Gaza, amidst the mayhem, a moment of melody. For children, learning music is not easy at the best of times. And for Mohammed, playing the violin, these are the worst. The 14-year-old lost part of his arm in an Israeli airstrike.
It changes the atmosphere of the war, from what has happened to me and from what is happening. It changes the mood when I play the violin.
He and his teacher, Sama, have to improvise, carefully tying the violin bow to his elbow with a scarf.
He is a child who used to play the oud before he lost his hand during the school bombing. I wanted Muhammad to continue his dreams by teaching him music and helping him achieve what he couldn't before. I decided to teach him how to play the violin because it was difficult for him to play the oud.
And that's the instrument, like a Middle Eastern lute, that 10-year-old Abed al-Rahman is learning. He had to have part of his leg amputated.
We were living a life of bombing and shelling, and I was injured in my leg. When the teacher came, we started practicing on something new, and we learned. When we practice, we can express ourselves and feel relaxed in our hearts.
His teacher is 15-year-old Salah.
The children are very happy to experience something new, like musical instruments. They are excited and keep asking us to come every day.
Both Salah and Sama were students at the internationally renowned Edward Said Conservatory for Music in Gaza City, but it was bombed earlier in the war. Over the last few months, they've been teaching in three schools now turned into shelters for displaced children and their families. One of them is 11-year-old Lina.
It's a beautiful feeling because when the teachers come, they help us escape the state of the war we're living in.
After a year of war, for these traumatised children, music offers a rare chance to let their hearts sing.
And that was John Donison reporting.
It is now 8:55. Coming up after the news at 9, Kirsty Young finds out what advice Miranda Hart would give her younger self in Young Again. But before that...
All right, Eliza, say it again.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
Painful still, isn't it? My Fair Lady is 60, which raises the question raised in that most famous of all the musical songs. Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? Or perhaps another question, is there a way to speak? Or does it matter how we speak? Or more importantly, what accent at least we have? Well, we're joined by two men who perhaps defy the suggestion that you have to speak like Henry would have liked you to have spoken. Tony Schumacher, writer and broadcaster, writer in particular of the Liverpool set, The Responder drama. Great drama, that. And Adrian Charles, our friend from Radio 5 Live. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning. Morning.
Tony. Have an Scouse accent. Has it done you down?
It's funny because I live about 200 yards away from where Rex Harrison was born, who was actually in My Fair Lady. And one of the things that Rex Harrison absolutely hated was the Lancashire accent as it was then. So he did everything he could to get rid of it. Actually, let me tell you, somebody said to me very, very early on in my writing career, It's so difficult for you because we know how to behave at meetings. Now they'd never, it's like I was going to put the coaster on my head or something like that. No, they would never in a million years say that to me if it sounded like I went to Eton.
That laugh, Adrian, that you have when he said that sounded like a familiar one. Have you faced the same sort of thing?
I've certainly faced the same thing, but in a similar way, it's always been to my advantage because it's about low expectations. People just think you're stupid with a Birmingham accent. There's still that latent kind of prejudice against it. So I've got to do very relatively little to impress people. You know, it's been the case since I started at the BBC 30 years ago. It was more true then than it is now, but just string a reasonably coherent sentence together. And they were looking at me like I was Stephen Hawking or something like that. The lad's a genius. I'm sure Tony got credit for not putting a coaster on his head at a party. He said, you have done well, haven't you?
Sadly, I put a coaster on my head at the meeting.
Oh, but dear, that's I'm sorry to hear that.
The point is that, you had John Cooper Clarke on before. And actually, I was reading Alan Bennett's diaries yesterday on the train. And Alan Bennett was lamenting, I think it was in the 80s, that somebody on this show called him Twee.
Yes.
Now, if he sounded like Jonathan Miller, they would never have said that. They would have said he's a great chronicler of our time. He's a brilliant, brilliant writer. So it's the difference between being funny and being witty, I think, is the thing. And it's the last thing, the last prejudice that you're allowed to have.
I guess the test, Adrian, is this, that for one of your children, for somebody who came to see you for advice, would you say, good God, don't talk like me. Learn to talk proper, in inverted commas, I stress.
No, that's interesting. I'd say, the truth will always set you free, you know, which is a tired old, a tired old maxim. But you just got to absolutely be yourself. And I think that's more important than anything. And I do worry we're slightly getting to a stage when it's a bit like the colours of cars and lots of other brands. Everything's lost its colour. All cars are a very intense grey or shade of grey now. I think everything's becoming homogenised in terms of accents as well, if we're not careful. It's a particularly wonderful thing about this country. You know, we've got to celebrate that diversity. And yes, we'll all have our own prejudices. You know, they'll all be all accents go, oh, I don't know, what are you doing operating on me? You know, when you've got that thick Scouse accent, you know, or flying this plane.
You do know what we're operating on you,
or a very thick West Country accent or something. You know, we've all got a bit of it in us, but, you know, we've got to get these accents out there and celebrate them.
What's your advice to your kids?
Well, I mean, I've got a 3-year-old son and I still keep, I'm panic stricken that he will sound like me, but I kind of hope that in years to come it won't matter. I hope that in 10 years' time it won't matter, but I've got a sneaking suspicion it still will.
But it's worse having kids who don't sound like you. My kids sound like minor royals to me, the way they talk.
Have you got posh kids, Adrian?
John Cooper Clarke sounds like a minor royal compared to you, Adrian. I mean,
well, look, here's my little confession as I thank Tony Schumacher and Adrian Charles. Thanks very much indeed. When I first presented